Hi, this is Bob Rozakis. You're listening to the Batman Family Reunion on the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Welcome to episode 481 of the Batman Family Reunion, a proud part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Bat Cousins, you heard that right, but despair not. You have not missed 460 episodes of Batman Family Reunion. We are just going to label the episodes to match the issue of Detective Comics that it appears in. So this is Batman Family Reunion number 481. It's been well established that I have trouble enough remembering the issue numbers, so if the episodes would have a different number than the issues that we're covering, whoo boy, no. Of course, I am Sean M. Myers, the M stands for Man-Bat, one of your hosts, and with me as always is my co-host and Bat Cousin, Paul Keene. How are you this month, Paul?
My stomach's bothering me a little bit. Bat Cousin Heath brought us over all Heath bars to eat, and I think I had too many of them. It's like the Clark bars all over again. But how are you?
I am great. I was talking to Uncle George, and he told me that he will be able to meet us at the Baltimore Comic Con, which is this coming weekend, September 8th, 9th, and 10th, and he's coming on Saturday, which is the big cosplay day, so I cannot wait to see his movie-accurate costume. This month, we have another special guest, podcast extraordinaire, toy expert, Justice League Unlimited superfan, and Fire and Water All-Star, that's right, our super friend, Bat Cousin Chris Franklin.
Yay!
Chris, welcome to the show. We had you on briefly for the Robin Christmas story, but we are very happy that we get you for the whole episode this time. I can't wait to hear what you brought for the reunion.
Oh, hey guys. Sorry, cousins. I was in the middle of a never-ending Frisbee contest with cousin Steve. He said he could do this all day, so I finally just gave in. So in honor of our second Batman story, I brought my daughter Danny's Bananas Foster Pudding. It's banana pudding, which is great, but Banana Foster Pudding is even better because of the caramelized bananas. It's preferred 10 to 1 by evil balding men who place their brains in albino gorillas.
Oh man, I can't wait to dig in. I guess I have to wait till the end of the show. So for the first time in Batman family history, this show is going to be 10 minutes long.
Somehow I doubt that.
Paul, why don't you remind our listeners what our show is all about?
So listeners, Batman Family was a DC comic. They ran for 20 issues from 1975 to 1978 and then rescued Detective Comics from the DC implosion by continuing on as a dollar comic for 15 more issues until 1980, starting with this very issue. The title started out with some new features starring Batgirl and Robin, along with reprints, before morphing into all new stories starring other members of the Batman family, such as the Huntress, Commissioner Gordon, Man-Bat, and even the Demon and Human Target. Both of your hosts collected and read these comics as they came out and are excited to share their love of this era at the Batman Family Reunion.
So, Chris, before we get started, I think we all know who your favorite Bat Family member is, Mr. Richard Grayson. But why don't you tell our listeners your history with the Batman Family title?
Okay, well, I just missed the run of the regular Batman Family title as it was coming out. I remember seeing some house ads in the earliest comics that I had bought for me, but I think the first one that I picked up was Detective number 487, which would have made me 4 years old, which Michael Bailey just said, you know, I had a comic book when I came out of the womb. But I'd already been getting Batman and Brave and the Bold for a while.
Since you were two.
Yeah, I was two. Right.
He's like, I love that Jim Aparo.
Yeah, that's right. Hey, I remember getting my Remco Energized Batman figure for Christmas and saying, this looks like that one guy that draws Batman, and it was Irv Novik. It looks like an Irv Novik. I don't know who Irv Novik is, but I know this looks like his Batman. So I had the detective issues that were the dollar comic with the Batman family, and I was really disappointed when it went back down to a regular size comic. I'm like, where's the Robin story? Why is it just Batman and Batgirl now? I'm so upset. But I did get to sample some of the actual Batman family stories in my beloved Best of DC Comics Blue Ribbon Digest number 51. You know, and I know Sean likes that. Yeah. When I discovered comic shops in the 80s, I was after every Batman comic I could find at a decent price and every story by Marshall Rogers. So that's why I picked up this particular issue. And it was one of the earliest ones that I picked up. And I actually got to meet Marshall Rogers in 1991. And he signed this in all my issues of Detective and my Batman Spectacular. So
very nice, very nice.
Fantastic. And right now we're going to get into Detective Comics number 481, starring the Batman family. The cover date is December 1978/January 1978, but the release date was September 28th, 1978. 64 pages, no ads, $1, 5 all new stories, and the cover artist is Jim Starlin. What do you guys think of this cover? Chris, would you like to describe the cover and give us your thoughts?
Okay, I know Mike's Amazing World said it was all Jim Starlin, but I think 4/5 of this is Jim Starlin, and the bottom part is Marshall Rogers, because it's a repeat of the splash page extended. So we get a lot of cover copy telling us about, you know, the 68 pages, no ads, blah, blah, blah. Above the Dollar Comics banner reads Gotham's Greatest Manhunters and 5 Fabulous New Thrillers. The title reads Detective Comics in the original font, which is cool, starring the Batman family. In the center of the cover, an image of Batman with gritted teeth floats toward us, a large skull with glowing eyes in the background. Behind the skull are a design which then rises to form the Gotham skyline, and the text reads, Murder in the Night, a Batman epic by Jim Starlin and Craig Russell, which they get their names on the cover, which was unusual in the 70s, right?
Yeah.
And to the left of this, we have vignettes of Robin, Batgirl, and Man-Bat with their story titles, which is cool. The back cover is also divided into 5 strips. Batman's silhouette looms over Gotham at the top. Robin, in his new costume, flies alongside the Raven. Batgirl is a stranger in a strange land on a Chinese dock, although it seems to be a Chinese dock from like the 1500s or something. It's kind of strange. And Man-Bat is depicted soaring through the darkened city, which is kind of generic, but he really looks good. So the bottom tier, like I said, seems to be by Marshall Rogers, partially lifted from the splash page. We've got the London skyline behind him, and it gives us also credits for Denny O'Neill and Marshall Rogers. It's a really sharp cover. It's very busy, and it shouldn't work, but it does. If you want to sell each feature, I can think of no better way to do it, because, I mean, this comic just screams value. You know, you're getting all these characters. You've got all these amazing creators, some of the top creators in comics at the time, for a buck. It's pitching it and it's selling it. I mean, any kid that could get a dollar out of his parents is walking home with this comic book. That's my opinion anyway.
How about you, Paul?
No, I mean, it's great. Unfortunately, to Sean's chagrin, it's the return of the box cover in a different way. And I'm sure he'll have more to say about that. But I like the image. Batman jumping out at us is, I think, better than that pinup we had an issue or two ago. Again, my preferences are the ones that have all the characters interacting. But you're right. It does scream value. There's no doubt that there's lots going on in this comic book.
Mm-hmm.
Bat Cousins, this is going to be a shocking episode, not only because it's 10 minutes long, but this is probably the boxiest of the box covers ever.
9 boxes.
However, not only do I absolutely love this cover, and I love this cover, even if you just take it as the front cover, I love it. I think when you open it up and it's like a 2-page spread cover, I think it's phenomenal. So not only that, but not to spoiler alert 18 episodes from now, but this is my favorite cover of the Detective Comics featuring the Batman family. I think this cover is spectacular. I love this cover. And I think my issue with like the boxed covers of the past is because usually it was like one image and then maybe text shoehorned in on the side or that kind of thing. I absolutely love the bottom, like the Batman silhouette.
Yeah, that's cool.
I actually think that should be the main cover box. Obviously, it would be configured differently. And especially because that's the first story and the other story is continued. So if I have a complaint, I would somehow like flip those two placements or images or whatever. I love too, like Robin, Batgirl, and Man-Bat, like they're all looking the same way. So that was kind of my issue with the Star cover. Is that 17, I think, when it first went to Dollar, like how some of them are looking poster size, other are looking action size. But like this, I love the cover copy, everything about it. I love this cover so much. One thing I want to say before we get into the meat of the stories, everybody knows about the run of Detective Comics that had Englehart and Rogers and just how classic that is. It was only maybe like a year ago when I realized how close these issues are to that run. It's only like 4 issues away from that.
Yeah, I mean, and Marshall Rogers only skips one issue. Marshall Rogers did 479. He had did three or four issues with Len Wein. Then we have Don Newton last issue. And then now it's Martin. We got Marshall. I think this was the original detective story and the other Batman was the original Batman family story, especially since this one says it was edited by Julie Schwartz.
Starting from here, I bought each issue off the stands, but I hadn't bought the Englehart Rogers run. Like, I didn't know about it until much, much, much later. I think I did know about the issues before they were reprinted in Strange Apparitions. But even in my mind, that's like, at the very least, a year before this happened. And then knowing that Detective Comics was going to be canceled, when you had that spectacular run, it's so hard for me to bend my mind around that.
I agree. It's crazy.
Yeah. It didn't take long for it to be appreciated, but it wasn't appreciated at the time like it, we think it would have been. It's kind of strange. I mean, it seemed like the Denny O'Neill, Neil Adams stuff was being appreciated in real time. But the Englehart Rogers stuff, it took like a year or two to kind of catch on, you know, which is kind of strange. But as far as where this, the first story, I know we haven't gotten into it yet. My copy up at the top on the after the splash, it says in pencil Detective 481, like it made it into the into the comic. I don't know if you guys have that.
I have that too. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So okay, you're right.
But does that mean it that's what it was supposed to be? Or does that mean, oh, now that Detective is saved, this is going to go into 481?
Yeah, I think the clue is the editor, because the other Batman story was edited by Al Milgrom, who, as we know, was canned by DC. Okay, all the rest of the stories were edited by Al Milgrom. So I think they were supposed to be in Batman family. So I don't know what got, maybe it was that Batmite story or some other story got pushed aside to have two Batman stories in this issue. Because this one was, like I said, Julia Schwartz, who was the detective editor.
That's some good detective work.
Thank you.
Well, and too, we were even talking about Marshall Rogers being on Detective. So, yeah, it makes sense that this would have been for Detective. Yeah. Okay.
All right. So now I will say that we'll post the image of this great cover, as well as plenty of additional pages from each of the stories in our family portrait gallery. Sean, can you remind our listeners what the network's website is?
Yes, it is fireandwaterpodcast.com. Now let's jump into that first story.
All right, the first story is starring Batman, as we've been talking about. It is called Ticket to Tragedy, a 17-pager by Denny O'Neill with the return, as we've been talking about, of Marshall Rogers. He also inked the story. It was not in the Strange Apparitions, because that was the Englehart run, but it has been reprinted in Batman in the 70s trade paperback, as well as the Legends of the Dark Knight Marshall Rogers hardcover. So not a lot of places. Batman is in London to protect Alfred's cousin, the noted heart surgeon, Sir Basil Smythe, who has been subject to death threats. One attempt fails, although his patient is killed instead. Batman finds that Sir Basil has lost his faith in humanity. He says, quote, "We spend billions on machines of destruction and pennies on medical research, and is ready to destroy his groundbreaking research, which could save thousands in the future." Batman agrees that the world is a tough place, but tries to convince Sir Basil that there is still justice in the world. Batman makes a deal with him that if he can find the killer by the time Sir Basil arrives in Gotham City 48 hours from now, he will publish the research. If not, he will destroy it. The only clue that Batman found in London was a limited edition ticket to the ceremonial maiden voyage of a new high-speed train ending in Gotham. Batman goes undercover as the conductor to collect all the tickets to see if one was counterfeit, but they were all genuine. But then Batman has a V8 moment when he realizes that the one person who didn't need a ticket must be the assassin. At the same time, Alfred deduces that Sir Basil had accidentally crippled the brother of the railroad's owner early in his career, and he wanted revenge. Batman sets out to find him and finds that the back of the train where he is has been disconnected and sliding back. He lassos the front part of the train with his bat rope and slides along the rail on his boots, pulling himself forward. He then does a Tom Cruise and pursues the assassin on the top of the train, of course. We cut to the Gotham airport, where Sir Basil has arrived on the Concorde. When asked if he would be staying long, he simply answers, "Long enough to smoke a cigar." But as he opens his lighter and is about to burn his research, he turns around to see a tremendous closing splash page by Marshall Rogers of the Batman with a killer in his hands. Click. The lighter closes, and the research has been saved. Chris, Sean, what'd you think of Ticket to Tragedy?
I'm going to let Chris go first, but I am going to interject just for a moment because I don't want Martin Gray to throw his iPod or iPhone across the room. I'm almost positive the man's name is Basil, not Basil.
I thought so the Martin... British said it Basil. I don't know. We'll find out. Martin, as our resident UK expert, please let us know whether you think it should be Basil or Basil.
Chris, what did you think?
This is Marshall Rogers' Batman at high tide for me. It's just beautiful. It's a gorgeous story to look at. His Batman is perfectly synthesized now to the Batman he'll always draw from here on out. Honestly, though, it's by no means Denny's best Batman story.
Agree.
And I prefer his collaboration with Marshall Rogers in the story Death at Midnight in 3 from the Batman Spectacular. I know Sean said he was a little disappointed in the Batman Spectacular last time because he built it up in his head, but that was like one of the first comics that I remember having bought for me. I remember specifically like saying, can I get this Batman comic? And my sister like coming over to my mom saying, he wants this Batman comic, and I got it. So I got a soft spot for it, you know. Brian and I covered that on Nightcast, and we actually did a dramatic reading of it. So that was fun. But this is still a solid Batman story by one of his greatest writers and one of his greatest artists working together. And actually, Marshall Rogers might be, you know, as far as just Batman himself, he is probably my favorite Batman artist of all time.
Cool.
Over Neil Adams, over Dick Sprang, just the way he draws Batman, because I think he understands the capage, the ears, the visual of Batman, I think, better than anybody. That's just me. But that's my personal opinion. So anything he draws, I mean, this could be written by, I don't know. But yeah, it's a fun story. It's got a few, we'll get into it. It's got a few logic holes for me,
yes.
But it's beautiful to look at.
Ditto. I mean, I'm like, man, I miss Marshall Rogers. I love Michael Golden, but I miss Marshall Rogers. I'm like, man, this was just something else. And I have written my second point. Story has plot holes, but exciting.
Big enough to drive a train through. Easily, Marshall Rogers is one of my top three artists, maybe one, maybe two. And it's tough because I have such a soft spot for Parabek, but it is almost like apples and oranges just because Parabek is so clean and unadorned and simple in the absolute best way versus Rogers, where it's just so intricate and detailed and just like the cape flows and just, I always talk about like that sense of motion and everything. This is definitely the case of an art form needing two halves. You know, you need the story, you need the art. In this case, the story isn't fantastic, but the art is like 10,000% over where it had to be. I almost think Rogers could draw Batman sitting in a chair. It would be interesting. I love this artwork. And the story is fun. We talk about that a lot. But yeah, so we'll get into it.
I like the first page. He's using shadow. We don't see Batman, but we see his shadow three times or his silhouette. And so that's kind of neat. You see the ticket to tragedy. Batman's holding the ticket in his hand, and that's where the title and the credits are. And then you see his shadow behind the Batman typeset. That's just a really cool effect. That's Zipitone, right, Chris?
Yeah, I think so. Or maybe Kraft did. Rob knows that stuff better than I do. But yeah, it's definitely one of those texture tricks that comic artists would use back then. And this is a great chance for Marshall Rogers to use his architectural knowledge. You know, he was an architecture student, and he always draws the best skylines. Now he's getting to draw London, so it's a treat. Yeah.
And that second panel where you see the shadow of the gun, oh, it's just so neat.
Yeah, I mean, it's great. So why were there two killers? I know one was to distract Batman, but he was hidden. Batman didn't see him. It seemed like a little overkill, literally, to me.
I think it was just to so Marshall Rogers could draw that really awesome scene of Batman swinging after him.
Okay.
Because it's so cinematic, because, you know, that he does the swoop down and then the jump up and then the jump back down and just the weight of his cape. You can almost hear it flapping, you know.
So you needed to have Batman clobber somebody first, and it can't be the actual killer, because then it'd be a two-page story. So
I thought Chris was going to say so he could draw the awesome panel with the two guns with the sound of, like, inside the sound effect. That's the panel. Like,
that's pretty awesome. Too.
Just the fact that there are two awesome panels on the second page just goes to show Marshall Rogers.
It's probably Julius Schwartz, though. Julius Schwartz was probably like, well, where's the action at the beginning of the story? You know, you need to, you know, grab him with an action set piece right from the start. His B.O. Schwartz, be original thing, you know, which I'm like, well, Why do you call yourself B.O., Julie? That's not a good, that's not, no, nobody needs to be called B.O., okay?
So Batman does his research, even on the London lowlifes. He knows this guy. You're Greeny Velvet. I love the guy's name. So Sean, he does not have Bob Rozakis' problem with naming villains.
I think he looks like a stretched out version of Dwight Dickles.
So then Batman goes into where the killer actually was. That's where he meets Sir Basil or Sir Basil. And we find out that he's Alfred's cousin.
Alfred's got a lot of family.
Alfred does have a lot of family.
Yeah.
They provide a lot of plot points, don't they? <Yeah. laughs>
And we see the body bag taken out, which is a little unusual. But look at the shadows on page 6. You've got, you know, Batman in shadow and Sir Basil, and you've got a close up to him, and then Sir Basil's in shadow. And the technique is just amazing on that page.
Yeah, it looks great. The previous page where Batman's coming through that window, that image of Batman, it was used, I can't remember where, but I remember it was used in a house ad by DC in the late 80s, but I can't remember what for.
Yeah. I'm not recognized. On page 5, he says, as I might have guessed, the storage room?
Yeah, yeah. Huh. Remember that was used for something. They just kind of cropped right around the Batman figure. Yeah, yeah. But I can't remember where it was used, but I remember seeing it. I remember that was like, well, where did that come from? That kind of looks like Marshall Rogers. And then I went back and looked at my books. Oh, yeah, it is from Marshall Rogers.
Very cool. Very cool.
And the amazing thing is, like page 5, there are 11 panels on that page. And literally every single one is interesting.
They're all interesting.
They're not the same.
Yeah, it's like nowadays, if you get a lot of panels, it's 9 heads and they're all saying something different. Yeah, it's not like that at all. It's very good. So then we get to the train in Gotham. I love Batman's disguise. And on page 8, how he bumps into that lady.
Yeah.
She's like, oops. And she spills her drink out the window. You didn't need to add that. That's just a cute touch, you know?
He doesn't have his disguise over top of his cow.
I was going to say that. I hate when they do that.
Well, Marshall Rogers draws like the thickest Batman ears of anybody, you know, like they're wide. They come into the center of his head more than most people. So maybe even he was like, this ain't going to work. Yeah, it just sucks. It's Bruce Wayne with a pillow and he's got makeup to make himself look heavy and a fake nose, but he's obviously Bruce Wayne underneath. So that's
kind of cool. Pretty cool. It's low tech disguise. He's got actually has a pillow, which I think is a riot.
One thing though, like I do want to backtrack to another plot hole. The whole thing about the doctor is so jaded that he's going to destroy this life-saving information. If you're at the point where you are so jaded, where you're going to destroy this, does it matter that Batman catches one guy? And I understand like he murdered the guy that you did this operation on. I think that, I guess, is the hook. I don't know if Dr. Ange, do you listen to this? I don't know. Like, I just can't, I'm not putting Dr. Ange on the spot. But like, I just can't imagine someone being, I have the cure for cancer, but if someone doesn't say please or thank you to me, I'm getting rid of it. Like, I just...
Right. If a member of the Justice League doesn't take time out of their day to prove that there's some good in the world, to hell with my Hippocratic Oath. I'm going to throw it all out the window. Yeah.
Whether he's Basil or Basil, he's a bit of a diva, let's just say.
And I understand it's there to create the tension and the stakes and everything. I don't know. I just wish there were other stakes involved. Yeah.
Speaking of low stakes, we got the guys who attack Batman in the back, which is kind of a filler sequence. Great action. Batman swings the trunk around and stands looming on them on page 10, but you don't really need that scene at all.
I will make up story-wise for like what we're talking about, the potholes. I love the fact that they're not attacking Batman. They're attacking someone who they think is a phony who is dressed up like Batman. I love that part.
I agree. Just to delay him. I guess it does make sense if they're there to delay him so he can detach the trains.
Even if you were like a criminal or a security person, like if you're going up against Batman, you're going to have mental reservations because this is Batman. They don't think that he is the Batman. Like, they think it's some guy. So you can go up to some guy and maybe win, but you're not going to win against the Batman. When he told them that this guy's a phony, he released that mental block.
Yeah, I love the panel where he lifts that guy up. Don't I seem like the real Batman? You know? Just like... And he's like, yeah. That image of Batman looming over them, though, on page 22. I'm not a tattoo guy, but if I ever got a tattoo, I'd get a tattoo of that. I'm surprised DC hasn't done more with that image. That should be a t-shirt right there, man.
What did you think of the Alfred scene, Chris?
Well, I tell you what, this is really interesting because I think when I first got this comic book, I keyed in on something that has stuck with me ever since. The Batcopter that Alfred gets in, it seems like Marshall Rogers had a Corgi Jr.'s Batcopter die-cast 1/64th Hot Wheels scale toy of the Batcopter, which was readily available in the 70s, because it looks exactly like the toy. I sent you guys some pictures of it and set them right next to the panels at the angles he drew. It doesn't say Batman on the side, but it does have the big bat signal symbol on there. The underneath, it has a very simple landing gear, the underside of it. In a few pages, when we see it again, it's the kind of Bell look. It's kind of a similar look to the 1966 Batcopter, the Bell helicopter, but it's a little more fanciful looking. But it looks exactly like that. So I'm figuring Marshall Rogers went down to the local drugstore, went over to the Rack Toys, and bought a Batcopter. Or maybe he just bought them because he was drawing Batman and he thought it was cool. But he's like, hey, I've got to draw the Batcopter, so thank God he didn't use the Mego one, which looks like a shoe, a roller skate, because that is a dope. I love Mego, but they made one dopey looking Batcopter. So at least it's this Batcopter. But I had to include that, being the toy guy. That's like,
yeah, it's awesome. The resemblance is amazing. I mean, yeah. we'll include some of these pictures, listeners, because Chris has put the copter in the exact same orientation as the comic, and they look pretty neat, but it is clearly what's in the comic is based on this toy.
I also want to point out too that Alfred uses a pneumatic tube apparently to get from the Wayne Foundation Batcave to maybe the original Batcave. So it's like Val Kilmer in Batman Forever, you know?
Oh. Yeah,
I mean, I love it anytime Alfred shows up, but Alfred doesn't do it. I mean, he figures it out, but he never actually speaks to Batman to tell him. So it's kind of a strange thing. You know, Alfred's rushing there, but he like never gets there. So I didn't quite understand the need for Alfred here.
It kind of reeks of season 3 of Batman 66, where I don't know if Alan Napier renegotiated his contract where he had to be included in more action, but Alfred just kept showing up in places Alfred shouldn't have been, especially to blow Bruce Wayne's secret identity. And it's like, we got to give Alfred so much screen time because it's in Alan Napier's contract. It's like in Alfred's contract here, he's got to appear in the story. He is Basil Exposition from Austin Powers. He tells you why this guy Solo is trying to kill Sir Basil. But he, like you said, he never meets up with Batman, which is really odd.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't get it. So here's a question for you, Chris, being more of an artist than us. Page 12, top left, first panel, you've got the flight attendant on the Concorde. That looks to me like a likeness of someone. I don't think it's Jeanette Kahn, but it sure looks like a likeness to me, like a very specific looking woman.
Who was the one lady that worked at DC that she was in the subscription ads with like Batman at one point in the 80s?
I remember that, with a headset, right?
Yeah, she had a headset and she was
Adrian Roy?
She was a colorist.
I know the ad you're talking
Adrian
about.
Roy did color this story.
Well, it could be Adrian Roy.
I don't know what she looks like.
Anthony Tallon, if you're listening to this, him and Adrian Roy were husband and wife. Let us know. Is this Adrian? Which Adrian was a longtime hero of Batman comics. Colored Batman comics for like 20 some plus years. But I was thinking it might be that lady that worked in the office that had something to do with subscriptions, because she was curly haired. I think Dick Giordano drew that ad. And of course, Dick Giordano drew it. She was very attractive. So might be her. I don't know.
Then we get the scene on the train. So what'd you guys think of this stunt where he's sliding along the rails on his boots?
I love it. I absolutely love it. Before that, how easy is it to uncouple a train? You see it in movies all the time, and really, you just pull that little pin out. It has to be harder than that, right?
And the train just kept going to Gotham, by the way. I mean, pulling the back never made it to Gotham.
I mean, I don't know if it's more, but I would have more, I guess, respect if it was like blown apart or something like that. But yeah, like the uncoupling of the train, man, it must be pretty easy to do that.
Far be it from me to rewrite Denny O'Neill, but this might have been a good time for Alfred to come in with the Batcopter and drop a rope ladder down to Batman, and then Batman catches up to the train.
There you go.
I love that idea in that panel. I don't think it's horribly far-fetched because I understand the train is much faster, but wouldn't it be similar to like water skiing? You could kind of make the analogy, the stress on your arms and your legs. Is it easier to water ski? Because here you have the rail.
If you slip off that rail, you get a big knee burn and nose burn and face burn, let me tell you.
Oh, yeah.
But let's say one thing. Look at the how he draws it on page 13, right? He got Batman. He's got the rope coiled around his arm, so he keeps it straight. So it's very...
And it's
very
behind
dynamic.
His back, too. Yeah.
And behind, he's tied it around his back. Looks like his center of gravity works. That's what's really remarkable about that. To me, it's the balance thing on the rail. Whatever he's got on his boots, you know, it's not like he has grease on his boots or something, right? But it is really a neat sequence, for sure.
It's amazing to think this is Batman before he was shown always wearing tactical boot soles. Nowadays, he's got bat treads. The first Hush cover where Jim Lee's got his boot in your face. And then he's got no grapple gun. He literally throws a lasso, not a batarang even. It's just lasso on the end and it hits.
Oh, you're right. It's a lasso. It's not a batarang. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. And lassos the back of the train car that's now the caboose. You know, and it's even more amazing. I mean, nowadays I can almost buy the modern Batman pulling this off a little bit easier than the Bronze Age Batman with his smooth soled boots and no grapple gun.
And the detail that he puts on it, like, look, you got Batman on the rails. But then he's even showing the bolts that are holding the rails to the railroad ties. Like, we wouldn't see that in a Vince Coletta inked story, right? And that would have just gotten me.
We'd be like floating in the air.
We'd be like, you forget the rail or the train.
Are the two people on 14, are they supposed to be somebody? The woman in the Roaring 20s outfit? Like, what's up with that?
Oh, I
know who
knew.
They are. Go, Sean.
Okay, I figured it's somebody that, again, once again, I don't get the pop culture reference. So let us have it, Sean.
It's more understandable that you would not get it. However, for all of my TCM-loving cousins, we'll let you know that that's Nick and Nora Charles, who starred in The Thin Man. And Asta, their dog Asta.
Oh, that's too funny. Well, Asta falls off the train, it looks like.
I don't like that part.
Batman just shoves the dog to the side. And then we get to the airport where Sir Basil gets off. He goes and guy says, are you staying long? Long enough to smoke a cigar. I mean, I don't know, but page 17 of the story, 19 of the book. I mean, that's one of my favorite Batman images. It's really, really fantastic. The way he's, don't you dare, Sir Basil.
So if we want to back up for a little bit, I do have a question about it. The guy's name is Solo, right? Bat Cousins, if you know if there's an episode of Mythbusters, do you want to like send me the link? Is it possible for two people to stand on a train? You see it in movies all the time. Is it even possible? Wouldn't it be the same as like standing on top of a car? The train's going like 30, 40, 50 miles an hour, right? But then also these people are having a conversation. Wouldn't it be really loud with all of the wind and stuff going and the sound? I would think it would be. But again, it's comics and it's fun. And I guess I can believe that more than the uncoupling.
Have you guys seen Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny?
Yes.
So more of that there. It's great scene, great sequence. But yeah, exactly.
I love that first 20 minutes.
Batman did it on the animated series, Christmas with the Joker. He had him and Robin had to uncouple a train and the Joker was blew up the tracks. And so Batman's done it too. Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. I bet you the Mythbusters have done that. So
probably.
So hopefully the Bat Cousins will tell you guys in the comment section.
Oh, I'm sure we'll hear about it.
That splash, it's a single image, but it says so much. One, Batman's body language and Solo's body language, who's apparently just passed out. And Batman's, the way his arms are all hunched up in his coat as Batman's got him by the back. Sir Basil drops his cigar out of his mouth.
Love it.
Flicks his lighter back closed.
Click. Yep.
Yeah, click. And then the end. What a great wordless silent panel. Yeah.
To me, that end, that image, the way it ends, that makes up for an awful lot of the craziness in the story.
I was kind of confused. Did he just happen to own the train? I mean, was he trying to get to Gotham because he knew Sir Basil was going to Gotham? He was going to kill him there? Or was that just a coincidence? I was a little foggy on that.
Chris, the answer is easy. The answer is yes.
Okay.
However, you've no-prized it for yourself to make it work for you. Yes.
Okay. All right.
Okay. Now we are going to move on to the Bat timeline. In this segment, we're going to take a look at the other titles that were published this month and what the Batman family was doing at that time. Now, a special note for the release dates in September of 1978, the DC implosion has arrived. DC has canceled 40% of their line. And their comics are now back to 17 pages of story for 40 cents. Not counting dollar comics like Detective and GI Combat, That means that there were only 20 DC Comics published this month at the 40-cent price. Conversely, Marvel published 37 titles, advertising that they were still only 35 cents, although within 4 months, they had also moved to the 40-cent price point. Nonetheless, there are still a ton of great books this month, and we're going to go through and see what was on our pull lists. And all of that information I just said is courtesy of Professor Paul. I did not do any of that research. Don't let it throw you why I came up with all this. And as always, we thank Mike's amazing World of Comics for giving us this information. The first Bat book is Batman number 306. And that is a fantastic issue. It's two stories, Night of Siege and The Mystery Murderer of Mrs. Batman. And it stars the tarantula, right?
Black Spider.
Black Spider, I'm sorry. Fantastic cover with Black Spider on the boat and Batman's leaping towards him and Black Spider's firing.
Yeah, this is one of my first Batman issues. I think maybe 303, I think, is my earliest one that I know for sure I got. That's the one where Batman is lying there dead and his ghost is talking about the fact that I'm dead. And that one, I think, is my early, whatever number that one was. But this is another very early one I remember getting.
Now, some of the titles had more than the 17 pages. But not all of them. I looked at most of them on here on Mike's Amazing World. So they were using still a few of the backups, but they cut that lead story to 15 pages instead of 17. So you did, for a month or two, get more than your 40 cents worth, but quickly settled back into the standard 17 pages. Next up, we have Brave and the Bold number 145, which is Batman and the Phantom Stranger with an awesome Jim Aparo cover and interior art story, of course, by Bob Haney. And I love it when the Phantom Stranger is depicted as a shadow on the wall like that. That's just such a great Phantom Stranger image. It's terrific.
The next issue is Justice League of America number 161, and it features Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, Flash, Green Lantern, Aquaman, Green Arrow, Atom, Hawkman, Black Canary, Elongated Man, Red Tornado, Hawk Girl, and Justice League member Zatanna. And I'm not sure if I ever admitted this on the show. I may have and may have not. I think this was my introduction to the character Zatanna, and this is what, 78? So I think from 1978 until I heard her name being said on Batman the Animated Series, I always said it as Zatanna. I think because of the because of Santana, like the musician Santana. So even though there's not that N, for years I would always call her Zatanna instead of Zatanna. So I think Batman Animated Series got me right with that.
Yet another reason to love Batman the Animated Series.
Yeah, well, she is a black magic woman,
you know, so. Nice. I got that one, Sean. I got that one.
And I want our cousins to know that was not pre-planned. I did not put in show notes about me saying that incorrectly. So good job, Cousin Chris.
This is my second Justice League issue.
The next issue we're going to talk about is Super Friends number 15. And of course, I'd let you guys know about For All Mankind, which is our network's issue by issue Super Friends coverage, which is soon coming to an end. And I'm going to be very, very sad about that. But of course, Batman and Robin both appear in this issue. And that is The Overlord Goes Under. And Overlord is a great Super Friends character.
And then finally in the Bat appearances, we've got World's Finest Comics, number 254, another Jim Aparo cover, a wraparound cover. This one, it appears that Batman is dreaming of Superman fighting Sinestro. Plus, we get features Green Arrow, Black Canary, Shazam, The Creeper. Dollar Comics were just the best. So, Chris, what do you have on your list?
Okay, I have Amazing Spider-Man number 187, which features Captain America and Electro. The issue inside is drawn by Jim Starlin, who's everywhere this month, apparently, working for both DC and Marvel. It's one of my earliest Spider-Man comics. This was one of my earliest comic months, apparently, guys. Sorry.
That's okay. We love that.
It's probably the first comic I ever bought with my favorite Marvel hero, Captain America. It was in an issue with Spider-Man, but I don't know if I knew Captain America before this. I may have even had the Mego figure already, but this is the first comic book I had with Cap in it.
I do really love the Electro costume, but I don't know that it makes a great silhouette.
Yeah.
Electro's supposed to be lurking in the shadows. I never thought of Electro as a lurking villain. He's kind of easy to see.
He's in green and yellow, and he shoots electricity, so yeah.
Yes, I think this one was on both our lists too, Chris.
Okay, cool. Another one I would have picked up if I'd seen it at the time was Power Records. Book and record set BR520, which is a Superman storybook and album set. I didn't have this one, still don't, but I did have the LP with the Mitch Spidlick story, so I'm well aware of that one. This looks like the cover is by Neil Adams with the running Superman image that was everywhere, and the Superman head in the background looks like it's just by Dick Giordano to me, and the interiors are by Kurt Swan. So what a package.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of Superman, another one I have to bring up is Superman number 330, which is the infamous story that establishes that Clark Kent has been subconsciously using super hypnotism to make people think he looks frail and older compared to Superman his entire career.
I love it.
Through his Kryptonian lenses, his glasses are made from the lenses of his ship. Between the two of them, he's been hypnotizing everybody. This was later mopeed away. You could get tomahawked and you could get mopeed.
Yes, really. That's awesome. That is a classic, Chris.
Continuing with a Sean theme of absolutely ugly, ludicrous outfits that are horrible, but I love, legitimately love, and not, you know, like I do love Spellbinder's outfit. It's an homage to the DC Go-Go Check top of the comic book. Yeah. I love this outfit. I hope in a couple days at the Comic-Con we get to see someone cosplaying, because I will have my photo taken with you. I'm gonna try to describe this costume. It's best just to Google search Superman 330. Basically an orange bodysuit with black boots, the hood, his left shoulder and right Speedo trunk and leg are Go-Go Checks. I would never say it's beautiful, but I love it and I'm fascinated by it. And it was on my pull list.
It's another one of those Carmine Infantino designs from the 60s, but man, it's great. And I thought they did a really cool update on him on Batman Beyond. He was a little cooler looking, but
that's
yeah.
The same guy?
I was going to say, I don't even remember it.
That didn't Batman occur to me.
Yeah.
Chris, you're just a font of knowledge.
I got to be good for something. You know, so. My final pick this month is Wonder Woman number 250, which, say it with me, was one of my first Wonder Woman comics. I think I may have got this in a Whitman 3-pack, which maybe some of the other ones came from too, which would explain.
Yeah, there's a Whitman, yeah.
So some, there's Whitman variants of it. In this issue, Wonder Woman is replaced in the Amazonian contest by an angry redhead. Sound familiar?
It is a great cover. Rich Buckler, Diana looks really like, whoa.
He looks so just vulnerable there, and that the proto Artemis is just smiling as Hippolyta puts the tiara on her and she's holding the magic lasso. It's like, oh man, this is the end of, I think this lasted for all of maybe two issues though. They didn't stretch it out like they did in the 90s, you know.
yeah that's a good one. That was on my list too, Chris. That's a great pull.
The DC implosion really hit me hard because I don't have a lot of choices this month. I picked Flash 268, and that is because the Flash is holding a Golden Age Flash comic, and the Golden Age Green Lantern and Wildcat are fighting him for it. And I've never read that story, but I would like to. I bet that's fun.
I picked that one up just a year or so ago and read it. I was like at an antique mall or something and caught it for $1 or something. And it's a really fun story. And it definitely ties into the fact that Barry Allen was a comic collector from Showcase number 4. So it was great.
The next one of my pulls is the Mighty Marvel Media special issue of Foom number 22. I have never held a Foom in my life. Technically, I have seen Fooms at conventions, and they are entirely too expensive for me to purchase. So hopefully Marvel will reprint them all, and I'd love it if it were the same kind of stock, but I know it's not going to be. The next one is Green Lantern number 111, and man, Alan was working it this month.
He sure was.
In this issue too. My next pick was the Superman book and record, of course. I don't think that cover is great, but I would have gotten it. And I've got it later, just like Chris said. My next choice isn't so much of a pick as a manifestation. So, of course, I'm talking about Spider-Woman number 9, because I want an affordable color reprint of that.
A dog with a bone. He's a dog with a bone.
I'm shooting that dream into action.
If the network can get the Who's Who omnibus is published, exactly. Why can't we get a Spider-Woman color trade paperback?
Affordable. Yep. My last pick is Hanna-Barbera TV Stars number 3. And it has Space Ghost, which is cool, Dynamite, which is cool, but it has the Herculoids, which are fantastic. I love the Herculoids.
So I just have a couple additional ones. The first one is one of these gold keys that I pick once in a while because the covers are just unbelievable. This is Boris Karloff's Tales of Mystery, number 86. So we've not talked about this particular title before. This one we see, just describing the cover for our listeners, we see an orange creature tossing a suit of armor over stairs at a group of people below, and the caption reads, "A stormy night, a monster on the loose. The setup was perfect." What does that all mean? How could the story possibly do this cover justice? But I want to read this and find out.
That's great. And Boris Karloff had already been deceased for like almost 10 years at this point. So. But he's Boris Karloff. So if anybody could host a comic from beyond the grave, it's Boris, who I just adore. Love that. More I read and more I know about Boris Karloff, the more I just love the guy. So
maybe you'll have to cover this comic on the House of Frankenstein, Chris.
Yeah, that'd be great. It looks cool.
That's probably hard to find, but can't be that expensive. My next one is DC Comics Presents number 4. I am a sucker for Chemo. Anytime he comes, and you've got a great art and cover by Jose Luis Garcia Lopez. Praise be his name. I also have Invaders number 35. Even as a kid, I chuckled at the superhero named The Wizard. And then, Sean, I am shocked you didn't take this opportunity. You missed it before to get Micronauts number 1. Here, this is why we can't have Michael Golden draw Man Bat anymore. I have this comic and I have my issue signed by Michael Golden himself, probably about 10 years ago at the Baltimore Comic Con. They didn't let him do the cover though, unfortunately. It's Dave Cockrum, still an awesome cover, but Michael Golden does do the insides of Micronauts number 1. And then last but not least, a self-portrait in Porky Pig number 85. Porky has opened the refrigerator to get a snack, and someone has hung a mirror on the inside of the door so he can get a good look at his big stomach.
Yeah, I don't like that at all.
I'm just teasing. It is a cute cover.
We have more downer news, because not only is this the month of the DC implosion, this is the month of the Rich implosion, because the Richie Rich comic count is down to 5.
Maybe they were affected by that same snowstorm.
Or is it a back to school thing? Because it's September,
maybe.
So the chillins are back in kindergarten, so we're only going to publish 5 Richie Rich comics this month.
I didn't even know who Dollar the Dog was. You got Richie Rich and Dollar the Dog, number 5.
Yeah. Dollar. Irona, Cadbury.
I remember Cadbury.
Know him more. I mean, I bought Richie Rich comics as a kid, but from the Hanna-Barbera cartoon in the early 80s. I remember a lot of them from that. Richie looked more like a teenager in that series than he did like a little kid, which is kind of strange. Maybe Richie invested in DC Comics and now, you know, he's imploded. You know, I don't know.
My Richie needs a massive part in the forehead, go-go shorts, and boots. That's my Richie Rich.
Well, then, you know, there's the whole Bart Simpson theory that Richie Rich is actually Casper. That's Casper's ghost of Richie Rich. So, you know, there you go.
Speaking of outfits and costumes, we are going to go to the second story, which is titled "Does the Costume Make the Hero?" starring Robin. It has 11 pages, and it was written by Bob Rozakis, penciled by Don Newton, inked by Dan Adkins, and it was later reprinted in Robin, the Bronze Age Omnibus hardcover. Robin in "Does the Costume Make the Hero?" Robin attends another meeting of the Robin Rooters, where he is presented with 3 new costumes designed by real-life comic book readers. He dials R for Robin and appears in his first outfit, a brown and mustard yellow number. While examining Gary Stevens' room, that's the guy that designed the stress tester from issue 19 with Chief McDonald, Robin notices that they are being watched by someone with binoculars. Robin realized that his outfit is entirely too ugly to have developed a fan base so quickly, so he knows something is up and switches out of that monstrosity lickety-split. His next costume is a much better red and yellow number, although it sure needs boots, and allows him to actually fly. He drops in on the stalker, only to be interrupted by Raven. No, not that one. And they have an aerial dogfight, or bird fight, which Robin loses thanks to an unfortunately placed wall. And inertia and gravity. One quick costume change later into a very generic green and blue outfit with fantastic gloves, I must admit. and Frank and Rob are on their way to Twitchell's garage because the chief recognized the stalker. Robin Kool-Aid mans his way in, teaches someone how important a muffler can be, and then makes his way to a dock where a superstitious, cowardly lot of a man tells Robin to stay away. Robin realizes that his costume is booby-trapped and manages to dive into the lake to protect himself from the blast of that outfit. By the way, I have never been more jealous of water than I am for the last few panels of this story. What did you guys think? Let's start with Chris.
Oh, yeah, this is a lot of fun. This is another reason I wanted in on this issue. It's the culmination of the ongoing campaign fans had for DC to give Robin a new costume. Actually see him wear three, as you mentioned. And it's drawn by Don Newton, who's one of my absolute favorite artists and a seminal artist for me when I was a kid. And I remember just being so just gobsmacked when the Meanwhile column came out that he had passed away. So I was just, it was the first time that like a creator's death really got me as a fan. Mm-hmm. So I've got this real soft spot for Don Newton. And the costumes, I can't wait to discuss them because there's some fun stuff going on and there's some choices. So
what did you think, Paul?
It's fun just for that. I mean, the noted part is, of course, the costumes, but it was interesting that they picked these three. I'm curious why they picked these compared to some others, but yeah, it's just a fun story. We get the return of Margie, who was the Robin Reuter chairperson previously. Why isn't he going after Margie? You know, Lori's dumped him. He should go after Margie.
Yeah.
So I know it doesn't line up time-wise, but was it the Clark Bar contest where you could be drawn into a comic? And I don't think that was over yet. But I want Margie to be the winner of that Clark Bar contest, and that's why she's in this issue.
Yeah.
I like this story for the costumes. It's really fun. It's nothing too serious. Now, what I'm about to say may not make sense, but for whatever reason, it makes sense to me. Generally, people know the kind of artist I like. I love George Perez, Mike Parabek, Joe Staton. They all have very clean styles, and I think kind of like lightweight. Marshall Rogers, I think, is very slick, that kind of thing. Don Newton isn't any of the, for whatever reason, I really attach Don Newton's characters as having weight and mass and bulk in a good way. They feel dimensional. Kind of doesn't line up with the kind of artist that I normally like, but I do like Don Newton's art a lot. My entry point was Captain Marvel, Shazam, when he started doing that for the last few issues and then World's Finest. And I loved the Schaffenberger of it all and that kind of stuff. But to have Captain Marvel almost now dimensional, that was incredible to me. And it kind of like is the same thing for here for Robin. Like, I just love the artwork. I don't think it's slick or pretty or that kind of thing, but it feels real to me in a way that some comic book art doesn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember reading a quote that Dick Sprang said that Don Newton was one of the best artists as far as anatomy that he'd seen draw Batman. So that's pretty high praise when Dick Sprang's giving you a shout out. Yeah, his stuff has that anatomy there. And he's one of the artists that made eventually Dick leave that costume behind because he fills it out. I'm still wearing my clothes when I was 16, you know, and I'm 19 years old, but it really works. He's Robin the Man Wonder, basically, the way he draws him, which George Perez runs with, of course. I love his Robin. And of course, he drew a lot of Robin when Dick came back into the comic when Jerry Conway was writing it, too.
The story starts out in the gym, and Margie is up on kind of like a stage, more like risers kind of thing. It's nice because there are three Robin costumes on dummies, and it's great because the costumes really are sagging like how they would. Mm-hmm. So that looks great. The other thing I want to point out is Robin, Margie, and there's three costumes. We're kind of like in the middle of the page. But at the bottom of the page, there are what, like 12, maybe 15 people, like the backs of their head. And they are really, really delineated. You can see each different person. The first 10 of them are all colored in blue in the same way. If each of them were differently colored, they really would be detailed enough that you would be able to pick up each and every detail about those people. It's not all generic. It's not just, oh, I put different hair on this, you know, like a video game, like when you pick your character and stuff. No, they have like different shapes and body types. I really, really like that.
Yeah. And I think Don Newton said he really liked Dan Adkins inking. Don Newton was apparently very particular about who inked him, but he put so much work into his artwork, you can understand why. And I think we're going to see Don Newton again in this comic. And I think Dan Adkins is a much more appropriate inker for him than what we'll see later. I think that's part of it, too.
And then the story goes on to literally spotlight each costume. Joe Montgomery of Abilene, Kansas, Paul Decker of Los Angeles, and George T. Johnson of San Francisco. We would like to have you on the show, I think we might be saying some bad things about your costumes, but we would love to have you on the show and talk about it if you would like to. So then this is my one thing. I wish they would have added something in here. So these people design new costumes for Robin, which I guess is fine, but there's no reason for it other than giving him new costumes. I think they should have had some charity angle where you paid money to design or you paid money to vote or something. Like, I think there should have been a deeper reason. One of them has like a utility belt, a jetpack. He has to learn how to use these things when he's out in the field. So I wish they would have added something like that, but they didn't. So then Robin goes in, puts his first outfit on, which is this brown and yellow mustard. There's only one redeeming feature about this costume, which is probably more Don Newton than the costume. And this is the birth of something that Nightwing is well, well known for. And that is Nightwing cake, which is fantastic.
Did somebody bring that to the reunion?
We know that Dick Grayson is having trouble with Lori and he has run-ins with Dave Corby. But at what point did that transfer over to Robin?
That's what I wanted to know. Yeah, I had the same question.
Because he's like an old-time saloon opening up the doors and he's emerging into the gym and he's like, hi, Lori. And then Lori's like, let's go. And then he's like, we're busy. Go feather a nest, bird boy. When did they start to hate Robin? And I understand that Lori probably knows that Dick Grayson is Robin. So did she tell Dave Corby that? Is that what that's supposed to be?
I think we're supposed to think that Dave Corby's the Raven. So that's why he doesn't like Robin. But Lori loved Robin before. So who knows?
Didn't he just save her from her psycho ex-boyfriend a few issues ago? I mean, why would you be dissing somebody like that? I mean, come on.
There's a little bit more rah-rah Robin, rah-rah, rah-rah Robin, rah-rah. So if someone creates a tune for that, I'll go ahead and sing that song, since that's my new thing.
But let's talk about this for a second, the personality thing here. Bob has given Robin a little personality saying, yeah, I guess it's my circus background that really, you know, I still dig this getting the cheers. Okay, I kind of like that. But he's so busy to not go after, you know, he's got all these problems. He's so busy, but he's got time to go to the Robin Rooters meeting, right?
See, that's why all of this can be explained with charity. You know, okay. I'll do anything to give money to people who need it and deserve it. That's my headcanon that makes me okay with this.
All right, I'll buy it.
Now, the next part I do really love, because Chief McDonald and Robin are studying the room, trying to find out what's going on. They're talking, but you can see Robin is writing and he hands this book to Chief McDonald. And then you see Chief McDonald reading his thoughts inside. Says there is someone watching this room through binoculars. Don't say anything. There's probably a bug. Please stand in front of the window. And then they keep basically like fake talking so that Robin goes out. And I think that sequence is great. I love that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a big fan of brown in general. And then when you pair that brown with mustard yellow, I think this costume is horrible. I'm very sorry to Joe Montgomery, who I just invited on our show. Watching your outfit, and you're probably not going to come, and I apologize. And this probably is better than anything I could have done. I don't know how to backtrack now that I've said horrible things about this, but I just don't like it. Even if it were like other colored, I don't know.
I just think if he comes on, he's going to be bringing mustard brownie to the reunion. Yeah, good luck.
I love all my Bat cousins, and I hope you show up to the reunion. What are your thoughts so people can direct their mail towards the two of you, too?
I kind of like this design. I do think I would like it better if it weren't these colors. His gloves and boots kind of have that bird feel, like the serrated look of a talon, which makes me think of Blue Falcon and Dinomutt. You know?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. So, and I do like the fact that he's got the underarm wings like the 90s Nightwing costume. So that's kind of cool. We don't see him use them, but they're there. So that's kind of neat. And his R is straight up the original Earth 2 Robin adult costume, the Batman-esque, like rummaging through Batman's closet and throw something together that day to go to that JSA meeting. That's that same R with the bat wings emerging from the center of it. So I kind of like that.
Well, and actually looking, I do really like the super, super high neck. I like that a lot. I think that's cool.
I don't like the color scheme either. The costume's kind of fine. I think the best thing about it's the boots and the gloves, but I wouldn't want to be the artist to have to draw that every time. All those lines for the hands and feet. Right? Yeah.
So he leaves Chief McDonald and he goes back and puts on what I think is the coolest outfit Although that outfit really isn't too far away from his normal Robin outfit. But I love the mask. The mask is kind of like his mask, but has much more of bat scallops, I guess is what you would say. So I think that looks cool. It's basically a red tunic with like a white utility belt. His cape kind of looks more like long peacock feathers, kind of, sort of. But it's just yellow tights. And I'm sure the boot is built in, but I do think it needs some kind of like other boot.
Yeah, and this one obviously has the color scheme that he's already got, which is good. I like his utility belt. Doesn't have a logo, though. So Batman wouldn't approve.
And of course, he puts on this outfit because he is going to get the person who was spying on him and the chief. And so the guy is up on the roof and he has binoculars. Robin swings in, but he's interrupted because then Raven shows up. I like Raven's outfit. I think Martin would say it does what it says on the tin. It's a raven. He looks like a raven. Super huge black wings, all black outfit. I like his outfit. And it is neat because now that Robin has the jetpack, they get to fight in the air. And that's cool. I think that's probably the best part of this whole this whole story.
Yeah.
And you get like great Don Newton art when Raven punches him in the stomach. I do really like that panel. Sorry. Sorry, Mr. Grayson. Oof. And then it's neat because I do really like it when you see evidence that he was an aerialist, how he tucks in and rolls. Mm-hmm. Like, I think that's fantastic.
That's cool. I had that note too. Like, I like the acrobatic moves for sure.
Yeah.
So just like I made Jim mad, I'm going to make Paul mad because at the bottom of page 7, there is an R on his utility belt.
Oh, look at that. You're right.
But it probably wasn't there a couple panels earlier. Flipping back. Oh, no. Okay. Yeah. So,
oh, it's at the very first. Okay. All right. I missed it.
Robin tries to throw a lasso around Raven, but ends up in the wall and then ends up in a bush.
I like this one. This is my favorite too. I think it's got the second Earth 2 Robin costume vibes about it, which is my, you know, I love the Earth 2 Robin. It's got the yellow tights. It's got the long sleeve red shirt. I think it could use a little green when it's somewhere. In fact, if they'd made the leggings green, it would have been kind of Tim Drake-esque, you know, so that'd been interesting too. But he's got kind of a Nightwing-esque mask, which is kind of nice. There's shadows of Nightwing in these costume reviews.
There really are.
It's really funny how that works. I just love it in the DC universe that college students can come up with a working jetpack, you know.
The science department, thank you.
Yeah.
So then he gets up from the bush, and it's funny, I didn't realize it until like just the second when he's running away from Chief McDonald. Because of the colors, it almost looks like a Flash kind of thing, I guess. Yeah, because those colors,
it's like Johnny Quick.
Yeah. And then I do like it because he's I have to go and pick up my cycle, like when Bugs Bunny like orders something through the mail and sends it in the post office, and then the mailman comes, because here he comes zooming up on his and yeah, I don't even know that like 20 minutes passed by. It seems like 2 minutes passed by, but I don't know where he had the costume and the cycle and everything. He rooms up on, and Chief McDonald gets on, and it is great because he says, next stop, Twitchell's Garage. And he says, just take it easy. Remember the speed limit. He says, when am I going to get it through my head that I can't compete with teenage superheroes?
That's cute. Yeah, that's cute.
So they vroom off into the night to Twitchell's Garage. And I guess this is where we'll talk about the costume. I think maybe, well, actually, no. I was going to say like singularly, maybe these things could work. But I think the only good thing, so I do like the gloves because it flares out at the arm.
Captain America gloves. Yeah.
So whatever that's called, I like that. And I do like the mask, but then we'll get into issues with that, I think, on the last page. What do you guys think of this outfit?
This is actually my least favorite because I think the design is just too generic. I mean, no offense to the person that designed it, because Paul said they're probably a kid, but it kind of looks like one of those, what were they called, where you can make the superheroes almost like the fashion plates for girls, but they were like monsters and superheroes or whatever. That's what it kind of reminds me of. It's a generic half cowl, cape, tights, trunks, boots, kind of got that look. And
yeah,
I mean, if the colors were different, again, I think I'd like it. There's way too much green. I know they're bringing in the blue because of Batman. And the yellow ribbed shorts are a really weird choice for the rest of it. It's really strange.
The thing I hate about that, and I am no fashion expert at all, I think it's almost a high-waisted Speedo, because you have the belt, but then you would have what would be like, I don't know, 4 or 5 more inches of the Speedo trunk. So like the Speedo, I think, is it like a Barbara Eden thing where they had to cover her navel or whatever? The Speedo, I think, would go over his navel, and I am not for that at all. But then like you have like the belt there and then like extra fabric on top of that. Yeah, I don't like that at all.
I just think it's kind of dull. You could walk into the superhero costume store and pick it off the rack. Robin needs a custom outfit.
And cousins, thank you for listening to America's Next Top Superhero. What's the other? Project Runway, Project Batcave. Thank you for listening. So we'll get back to the story. I do like this part because he barges into a garage. And then, of course, people are going at him with a tire iron and he picks up a muffler. So I like that. Know your space and the space you're in. So that's great. I love that part.
How do you put an explosive in a costume? How does that work? Wouldn't he have noticed a bomb when he put it on?
I didn't want to tell you guys this, but I have Tim Gunn waiting to talk to you about that, about fashion.
Okay. I stand chagrined.
I just got word that Tim Gunn is the pseudonym that Joe Montgomery used, and now he's not going to talk to me anymore. So, but yeah, so Robin rushes towards the dock, and then the guy flips out. No, don't come near me. Don't come near me. I don't want you anywhere near me, because his costume is booby-trapped. He jumps in the water, gets rid of the costume, and he even makes a point of talking about skinny dipping, which I wholeheartedly approve. So I do like Don Newton, and I don't know if this was him, but his mask, the second panel where it's just a close-up of Robin with his new mask, the mask comes up over his nose, but then towards the nostril, and then over? It's not even. Is it supposed to be a shadow?
I think that's a shadow. Are you talking about the center image of him on the top of page?
Yeah, right here.
Yeah, I think it's a shadow.
I think it's just a shadow.
Yeah.
The last panel, and again, I do love Don Newton, so don't at me. Then here, then that side looks way too high.
Yeah, it's shrinking because he's in the water now, right? He's made out of cheap fabric. No, it's another reason he's not going to keep it. And yeah.
Well, and really, he could have gotten rid of that mask and just clipped out another mask with his little bat scissors from his utility belt, like he did in the restaurant. Maybe there was reeds, like the things by the water that he could have cut up and used for the mask.
All right, this is degenerating. Fun story for the costumes, but before we leave, I want to talk about Dan Atkins. So it's time for the Bat Family History segment. I'll put a bunch of links in the show notes as usual, but a lot of what I'm going to say is from, there was an obituary for Dan written by David Spurlock and Tim Lasciuta, and there's an interview in Comic Book Artist number 7 that was conducted by John B. Cook. So those are the main sources for this information. Dan Atkins, who read comics a long time, you've seen his name on quite a few of them. He was born Danny Lee Atkins in 1937 in West Virginia and later moved to Pennsylvania when he was around 7 years old. When he was young, he spent a lot of time reading comic books, especially after he contracted rheumatic fever at the age of 11. So temporarily paralyzed from the waist down, he voraciously read comics. And after his recovery as a teenager, he discovered EC Comics, which introduced him to people like Wally Wood. And quote from him, "I got into reading EC Comics around Weird Fantasy 11 or 12, just when they were really starting getting good. I liked Williamson and Davis and Crandall and Evans. All the top guys were my top guys. But Wood was number one. We'd be looking for Wally Wood covers at the drugstore in our hometown every Tuesday and Thursday when comics came in. I wasn't yet into DC Comics or superheroes, but later on I got into Kirby." So after graduation from high school, Dan joined the Air Force and worked as a draftsman at Luke Field in Phoenix, Arizona. His duties included updating blueprints and illustrating electronic schematics and design changes. I thought that was neat. As part of his duties, he also created posters for the base library and movie theater, in addition to a monthly magazine of upcoming events. And it was there that he launched the fanzine named SATA, S-A-T-A, in 1956, which I was not aware of. It was a science fiction fanzine. It was produced on the base's mimeograph machine. In the alter ego interview, Atkins told Roy Thomas that as an illustrator, I had a whole room to myself with equipment to turn out posters and put in front of the base library and movie theater. We also did a magazine where we list all the happenings. We had to spend a certain amount of money per month in order to get the same amount next month. And I couldn't come up with enough things to spend the money on. So I started the fanzine. The Air Force paid for SATA. In the 1960s, he moved to New York and he met Archie Goodwin, Frank Frazetta, Steve Ditko, Al Williamson, and entered the comics field in 64. And that's where he met his hero, Wally Wood, who then asked him to join his studio as an assistant. His work with Wood is some of his most famous, for he assisted him on all of the Towers comic superheroes for 16 months, penciling, inking, and even writing some of the adventures of the Thunder Agents on occasion. One of his scripts, A Matter of Life and Death, number 7, featured Mentor giving his life in a battle with the evil subterranean warlord, causing a group of outraged fans to invade the Tower offices in Manhattan to protest the superhero's death, which was a very unusual occurrence in the 1960s. Which I thought was a funny. Anyway, while he was looking for Wood, he met Jim Steranko. And not long after, Steranko landed the Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. feature in Strange Tales. And Adkins brought it up to Wood saying, hey, that kid just got his own book at Marvel and is getting full credit. Wood then told Adkins, go sign your name to the story you're working on. And then Adkins started getting more credit. But before long, he went to work Marvel too. And that's when he landed Doctor Strange, which was featured in the same book, Strange Tales with S.H.I.E.L.D. They were both being experimental, and it was difficult to know whose feature was more far out. Steranko recalled, quote, Dan and I started out as rivals. He was Woody's assistant, and I was a Wood imitator. I was visiting Wood one day in a white linen suit and accompanied by an off-duty Playboy bunny, which alienated the hell out of everybody but Woody. Who does this guy think he is? Adkins told me he'd remark later. I'm going to blow him off the map. And he got the opportunity when we competed in Strange Tales. Blowing me away, however, is more easily said than done. He soon acquiesced, and I didn't rub his nose in it much, and we became good friends. I just thought that was really funny. Sorry, I'm laughing at myself. Anyway, Adkins' most famous cover of this time, if it's not his entire career, came when Strange Tales turned into Doctor Strange and S.H.I.E.L.D. got his own book. And so the premiere issue, number 169 of Doctor Strange, that's a Dan Adkins pencil and ink. But it soon became quickly apparent that he could not pencil and ink both a full-length book as he had with a smaller 10-page installments. And that's when he gravitated to inking. Inked a lot of Doctor Strange, Submariner, X-Men, Silver Surfer, and Conan the Barbarian. And then after being mugged and having his place broken into in New York, Adkins moves to Ohio for about 6 years, and he mentored a lot of unknown talent. One was former Bat History subject, P. Craig Russell, but also Val Marriott and Paul Gullacy. And in Comic Book Artist number 7, Gullacy said, Adkins was one of the most eccentric little men I've ever met, but a sweetheart. Dan was very knowledgeable. He knew about technique. He was the guy to go to for critique because he was the guy who would tell you what was wrong. He knew everything. And if he didn't, he'd network around to find out. He'd call Frazetta in the middle of the night and say, hey, what did you make on that last job? Or he could call Frazetta and talk about a hangnail on the guy's toe. So finally, he moved back east in 75 to New Jersey so he could commute to work full time at Marvel. For a few years, he served as an art director on Marvel's line of about 15 black and white magazines like Dracula Lives, Monsters Unleashed, Vampire Tales, that kind of thing. In 1977, he moved to DC Comics and he was assigned to work with Don Newton on Return of the New Gods and later on Batman. Working with Newton was Adkins' most memorable assignment at DC. He first teamed up with Newton on New Gods in DC Special number 28, and the result was a pencil inker team that would work on 49 stories, 694 pages together. We were a good team, said Adkins. He liked the pencil and I liked the ink. As his career wound down in the 2000s, he illustrated Parker Brothers products. I thought that was cool. He passed away in 2013 at the age of 76. So Dan Adkins' career spanned 5 decades in the comic book industry, starting as a fanboy in the early 50s, working as a penciler, inker, writer, painter, and full-time art director. Mike's Amazing World shows only 288 story credits at 4,400 pages, many, many covers. I think that a lot of his other work is probably not listed, but thanks for letting me go on a bit about him. That's Dan Adkins. Cool dude. I like the stories of him and Jim Steranko. I thought that was kind of fun.
Yeah, have any of you guys ever met Jim Steranko at a con?
I did once. Yeah.
Yeah, I can totally see that. He is a larger than life persona. He was very friendly when I met him. My son Andrew, like, we're on an elevator with him. I've told this story before. We were at Heroes Con. He was asking how he liked the show, and it's like, oh yeah, we like it, really enjoying it, Mr. Steranko. And he said, well, come by and stop by and see me at my booth. And so I did later. And I told Andrew when he got off the elevator, I said, well, if the elevator got stuck, he could have got us out because he's who Jack Kirby based Mr. Miracle on. So, but Dan Adkins, I can totally see the Wally Wood, that he was a Wally Wood student, the blacks, the shadows, it makes perfect sense. And then the people that he trained, the Paul Gillespie and all those guys, that tradition of the kind of the Wood style filters through all those guys through Dan Adkins. So that's really cool. I always thought he was a great inker, but I didn't know until you told me all this that he was that influential to all these different creators. So that's really cool.
That's neat. All right. Ready to move on, Sean?
We are. We're going to move on to the next story, which is A Slow Death in China, starring Batgirl. It's 9 pages. It was written by Bob Rozakis, pencil by Don Heck, inked by Robert Allen Smith, and it was later reprinted in Batgirl, the Bronze Age Omnibus Volume 2 hardcover from 2019. Batgirl in A Slow Death in China. Senator Cleary, Barbara Gordon, Leslie Talburn, and others arrive at the Peking China airport, not to catch a connecting flight, but instead to catch a hand grenade from a local radical. Luckily, Leslie, a high school classmate of Babs, is better at roughing up the bad guy than she is at her reporting job. Later that night, three more examples of the Sino-Supermen show up to kidnap Barbara, but this time, both Leslie and Batgirl put an end to the hubbub. This activity makes Wo Fong change his original plan, and now he decides to send two other Sino-Supermen back to kidnap both of our fierce fighting females. What did you guys think of the story?
Oh, Chris, you're on mute.
Chris was on mute, but I think he sums up what I think of the story.
Yeah, maybe I should just mute myself again. I wasn't a big fan of this one, I'll be honest. I'll get into some of the reasons why later, but it's fun. The Sino-Superman, the alternate superheroes are kind of fun, particularly one we get, which we'll get to when we're talking about the story, but this is my least favorite story in this issue for sure.
You guys catch the typo on page 2?
Yes.
No.
The very first line, it was supposed to be a warning of relations between two countries. It should be warming. It is not corrected on DC Universe. I didn't look in the omnibus, but I would bet it's not corrected there either.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I love how Barbara just says, I'm going to go to China and look for the Sino-Superman. Like, China's a pretty big place, I think.
Like Mr. Spock said in Star Trek VI, only Barbara Gordon can go to China.
Yeah, right. I guess I don't know that we're going to go beat by beat by beat. And there aren't really that many beats in the story at all. I think I'm prepared to do like an overall. There were maybe two things I liked about the story. The rest I kind of thought was just blah. First of all, I think it is neat that Leslie Talburn is very proactive. You can, so I'm air quoting this, you can understand how someone would think that this theoretically could be a Batgirl because it is a woman of a certain age, certain body type who is going into action. Granted, she is literally standing right beside a redhead who is exactly the same way. So I do like that. That kind of adds like a little bit. But I really hate that she is, I guess, like a news photographer and gets off the plane and doesn't realize that she has to take pictures.
Have we seen her before, Sean?
I don't believe so. Now, maybe when Batgirl had the backups, maybe Bat Cousins, this is the time for you to chime in. Let us know that we're wrong and how dare we. I will welcome that. But to my knowledge, I don't think so. And certainly if it was, she wasn't a major part. But I do like her.
We've given Don Heck a rough time on several episodes. I do like page 3. I think the little action sequence of Leslie going into action is pretty good.
I agree. Yes.
She kicks the guy, tosses the other guy, grabs the grenade, throws the grenade, would make Commissioner Gordon proud, throwing the grenade away. I guess it's the top half of that page. I thought it was really well done. So that was the one thing I really liked about the story.
I do like the Sino-Superman outfits.
Oh, yeah. The guy who has the Firestorm flame hair hat.
Yeah.
Yes. That's the best outfit.
You can tell Al Milgram was the editor of this story. All the DC superheroes they could use, and he makes Sino Firestorm part of it, you know?
Bat Cousins, you're hearing this a few days before the convention. We're recording it about like almost a month before. I wonder if I have time to put together an outfit like that. Because under his hat, the guy's bald, so I could make that work. I would wear a short kilt like that. Like that's, if there are any seamstresses or seamsters in the listening community, let me know and maybe I can get an outfit together for next Comic-Con.
I do like that we get a female Sino Flash and a female Sino Robin. So
yeah, that's kind of neat.
First female Robin, maybe? I don't know. Carrie Kelly, free Stephanie Brown, I don't know. So I do have a question, though. When these guys, and I know they did this in the previous chapter you guys covered of this, when they blow up, not to be graphic, but is there like gore all over the room?
I mean, we think it's just dust, like when the Avengers turned into dust.
They Thanos them, snapped them, right?
Actually, I think I have an even better. I think we did say like the Avengers dust, but I think it's the colored powder in the Batman movie, the Batman 66 movie, like when it's all that's what I think it's like.
They're going to mix them all together and get them all mixed up. Yeah. Like, you know, when the Penguin used it on the bad guys earlier, be careful, every one of them's got a mother when he's like, you know, sweeping them up.
I reread all of these, I guess maybe like a year or two ago. I haven't done like a reread. There's this epic battle going on in the room, and Barbara Gordon theoretically is asleep during all of it. And then Leslie does call her out on it, and she says, well, why don't you get an aspirin for your head? I'll come in and explain in a couple of minutes. But then, of course, they get kidnapped. But I would really want to know what her explanation was. Maybe she's going to come out as Batgirl, which would be great.
Some silliness going on there. I don't have anything else to say about this story.
Bat Cousins, if you love this story, now's your chance. We may retroactively add you to this podcast to talk about it. I'm ready to move on. Because this is the dollar comic, it doesn't have ads, which I'm actually sad about. We get what we're going to call a title page, which is like a really lazy title page.
Yeah.
It's basically a cityscape. My guess would be it's probably repurposed from a Marshall Rogers kind of
I think thing. It's the same as on the bottom of the back cover. You know how they repeat backgrounds in cartoons sometimes? I think they
yeah.
just...
Yeah, I don't know. It's got a signature of TK. You think that's Todd Klein?
It does have a TK.
Yeah, I didn't notice that, yeah.
Because he was a production guy and, of course, a big letterer. Yeah. Designed logos.
He probably did all the lettering and the bat signal coming out, but that's an excellent point.
So I do kind of have a beef. So it's like, now, two Titanic mags in one, and it's like a spotlight. And I love spotlights, especially Batman comics, so it's great. And it's Detective Comics starring the Batman family. And I know on the cover, the word family is just hanging loose, like it doesn't have that little box that it normally does. But that's because on the cover, if you had the box with family, you would lose a lot of like the cityscape. Mm-hmm. So on the cover, I'm fine that the little family, quote unquote, box isn't there. But it looks really weird not to have the little lines drawn from like the Batman cape underneath the family. I don't like that.
They did a lot of this stuff really last minute. You know,
because that is true. That is
so. I'm gonna give them a pass on this table of contents page because the Batmail family is just the Batmail family from Batman family. You know, there's nothing about Detective in there. Yeah. So that they just lifted from whatever. There's no acknowledgement about this in there. And I don't think we get that till next issue.
Thank you for introducing that to my understanding, and I am much more forgiving of this page now. I have grown as a person. But on the inside back page is the Batmail family. And as always, we are inviting Bob Rohde, Dave Ilyea, Wallace Hopkins, Scott Hoover, Kevin J. Dooley onto the show because you could join your letter column mate, Martin Menza. Yay!
There he is.
We had him on the show and he had a letter, this letter, which is fantastic. So Martin's letter says, I really liked Assault on the Pentagon. Because it showed just how important Batgirl's utility belt is. I don't like to see that kind of story all the time, but when you do one, it is well worth reading.
Yay, nice point, Martin. Good job.
Thanks for coming on the show, Martin. You were great. Wonderful, wonderful. Bob, Dave, Wallace, Scott, Kevin, if you're listening, we'd love to have you on the show. I also want to point out Bob Rohde, who we actually believe is the author, Bob Rohde. His last line of his letter is, as for Michael Golden, oh, what words. I'm so glad that the age of realism, quote unquote, in comic art is over because the new young artists like Golden and Marshall Rogers have such a tremendous flair for stylizing their stories. Rogers, in his detective stories, used a marvelous cinematic approach that my friend Dean Mullaney compared to Citizen Kane. And of course, he is right about that. Golden's more subdued style is still so perfectly raw that I find myself thinking of him in the same class as Mike Kaluta and Bernie Wrightson. I pledge this, gentlemen, as long as Michael Golden is drawing this comic book, I will not miss an issue. Hear, hear.
Yeah, the only one I want to point out is Scott Hoover says that the mystery wasn't so tough to figure out, by the way. As soon as I saw a pantless man bat swooping down on the crooks, I realized it was actually She-Bat. Now I can't wait to see what happens in part two. So we're not going to revisit the whole Fran Bat, She Bat storyline, but I thought that was funny that he pointed that out.
I think you guys got a celebrity though. Kevin J. Dooley is, I believe, Kevin J. Dooley, the DC Comics editor and writer.
Oh, you're probably right. And yeah, he goes on about Joe Staten, about what a good artist he is. That's an excellent point, Chris. I didn't even think of that.
Yeah, and he worked with Joe Staten on the Guy Gardner comic in the 90s, and he was probably most famous for being the editor during the whole Emerald Twilight where Hal went nuts and became Parallax. There you go. That's love him or hate him. There he is.
There you go. Very cool, Chris. Good pull. All right, let's go on. I'm going to talk about the fourth story, which is starring Man Bat and Jason Bard, entitled The Whittle Snatch, an 11-pager written by our Bat cousin Bob Rzakis with art by Don Newton and Dave Hunt. as far as I can tell, has never been reprinted. Kirk Langstrom is doing his best Humphrey Bogart impression while he tells his wife Francine about the first case of the PI firm of Bard and Langstrom. It started in their office when Mr. J.J. Whittles comes in to hire the pair to find his wife, codenamed Snookums. It seems Commissioner Gordon did his daughter's ex a solid by referring Mr. Whittles to them. So Mr. W. promptly fired the other PIs he had hired to look for her and engage the services of Bard and Langstrom. Jason was the bait, carrying the ransom money while Man-Bat circled above and followed the perpetrator. But false alarm. Turns out one of the fired PIs sent the ransom note to scam Mr. Whittles out of some cash. Back to square one. Kirk and Jason have a typical PI meal of donuts and coffee at the diner to discuss the case. Turns out Mrs. Whittles had been taking dance lessons, and her instructor told Jason that she wanted to learn all the dance moves. The pair sets out to search all the discos, and of course, they find Mrs. Whittles Saturday night fevering away. After they locate her, another goon tries to actually kidnap her, but the action duo of Man-Bat and Bard make quick work of him too. He turns out to be another of the fired PIs. But Bard and Langstrom got their woman, and she is happily reunited with her Snookums, at least if she gets bored again and wants to head out to Long Island to check out Gabriel's horn. The end. Chris and Sean, what do you think of this adventure starring Bard and Langstrom?
This was fun. I'm not sure the airheaded younger wife and cockled husband trope holds up too well today, but maybe that's a universal thing, and maybe it does. I don't know. You know, but it's a fun story for Man-Bat's first issue of Detective, even though this was probably prepared for Batman Family.
Yeah, exactly. I love that. Sean, how about you?
Bat cousins of a certain age will remember the NBC Mystery Movie, which was like a rotating series which had McMillan and wife, McCloud, the Snoop sisters. I know we talk about Gabriel's horn, but this is a 1970s police detective story. And maybe that's why I love Man-Bat as a story, because that's when I came up. But this exactly is a TV, maybe not pilot, but it is an episode of an unproduced 1970s detective story. And I love it so much. Oh my God, I love it.
From a technique perspective, I do think what's done here is Bob has taken a pretty simple story and shifting around the flashbacks makes it a more interesting read. So just from a technical standpoint, because the plot is very simple. The woman got away from her dusty old husband to go dancing. She's out on the lam and he hires these PIs who then try to cheat him after he fires him. And then they find her. I mean, that's it. That's the story, right? So I just think that's fun. Did you guys catch on the newspaper, the letterer Ben Oda puts Don Newton and Dave Hunt in the newspaper? I thought that was kind of a cute nod.
On story page six, right?
Story page six. Yep. Right down the corner. Yeah. Thought that was kind of cute. But, you know, other than that, very straightforward, kind of fun. I agree with you. It's kind of fun. It's interesting. He starts out telling Francine and there's little Rebecca there getting her bottle.
I think it's interesting that the way Don Newton draws Langstrom, he looks more like the way Neil Adams started drawing it.
Yes.
Because like, Michael Golden makes him look like he's one of the Eagles back in the 70s. Don Henley, you know, all of a sudden, he's a little bit older, got a little bit of a receding hairline. And I think it actually works better for Kirk Langstrom's character myself. Not that I don't love Michael Golden, I do.
I've talked about the previous Man-Bat art, which I think is absolutely stunning and beautiful. I would not put Don Newton on that level. But I enjoyed this art a lot, and especially the weight and like the dimension of it works fantastic with Man-Bat.
You know, Chris, now that you said it, I do notice paging through this versus the Robin story. I think you're right about the inker. I definitely like the art in the Robin story better than the art in this story.
Dave Hunt is a very kind of like what Sean was saying. He's kind of got that smooth style. They put him on Kurt Swan and Kurt Schaffenberger a lot.
Yeah,
in the late 70s, early 80s. Yeah, and it's just not bad. It's not a bad look, but it doesn't look as Don Newton-y as the Robin story. I think Dan Adkins inked the way Newton would ink himself, and Dave Hunt does not. It's not a bad combo, but it's just not, I don't think it's just powerful. And it's, well, maybe this ink suits this kind of more lighthearted story, but the moodiness also may have worked better because of the noirish private eye aspect. So I think either one could work, but it's fine. It's just not as good, you know?
Well, so I do have a question. I don't know if this is the artist or the inker. On story page 7, when Bard and Man-Bat go to the dance clubs and everything, you see Jason has a picture of the wife. And then when you flip the page, it's story page 9, and it's that middle panel, and you see the wife. Is that like a rough night of dancing and drinking and not staying up late? Because maybe a nose job, because this woman does not look like that same woman. Are we sure they got the right woman? Because I don't know that that's her.
Maybe the picture was when she was 15 years younger, Sean.
Yeah, maybe it is Don Dutton being sly about it. He keeps this picture of her because this is the way he still sees her. But now she really doesn't look like it anymore because she's done some hard living, you know, clubbing with all these guys while her husband's at home, you know, working late at the office or whatever.
So in the spirit of me giving with one hand and taking away with another, page 8, I love that bottom panel where you see Man Bat in the background in shadows, and then the guy with the cigarette in the foreground with like the shadows going. I think that is fantastic.
Good.
I love that artwork.
Yeah, that is. In the panel before that, that's like a really creepy image of Kirk Langstrom where his eyes are going red.
Yeah.
He's talking about one Man Bat reconnaissance coming up. It's sinister looking, really. I mean, he looks like a supervillain right there. So it's,
I wonder, did he just pop the pill and his hand fell out of the panel? And then, like, he's starting the, like, in the Incredible Hulk with, like, the eyes.
Yeah.
Maybe he's starting in the spirit of Zatanna. It was 3 times that I read this because I didn't understand what the Man Bat Renaissance was. I'm here for the Man Bat Renaissance. But I don't know what it has to do. And then I'm like, okay, recognizance. Okay. Okay, another thing I didn't like. Kirk, you need to stop calling Jason Jay, because I don't like that. He's Jason. And I love on page 4 how you see Man Bat from the back looking with binoculars. A fact. He has collapsible binoculars, like he has collapsible shoes.
He's got the sonar, but his eyesight isn't very good.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. It is kind of weird, though. I always find it interesting, these stories. Who freaks out about Man Bat's appearance and who doesn't? Because the private eye at the end who kidnapped her, there's this winged, monstrous creature coming at him, and he could care less. He just swings at it, punches him with some brass knuckles, and
that looks like it hurts, those brass knuckles.
Oh yeah, the way that Don Newton draws his teeth with fangs protruding out when he punches him is great. I really like Don Newton's aerial acrobatics again, like the Robin story, just the images of Man Bat flitting around and flipping, and the way his wings are moving under his arms is just, it's just really, really super well done.
Okay, our next story is the last story of the issue, and it is Murder in the Night, starring Batman. It's 16 pages, written by Jim Starlin, penciled by Jim Starlin, and the inker is P. Craig Russell, and it has not been reprinted. Batman in Murder in the Night. Batman's incredibly maudlin reverie is interrupted by a call from Gordon, letting him know that Ronald Thursgood has been murdered. Looking over the crime scene, Batman doesn't seem too torn up about seeing a body that's been torn up. But when he sees a photo of Thursgood in his Black Hawk days, the memories light the corners of his mind. And he's transported back in time to when he was a 5-year-old child and his father lovingly told him all about an army buddy named Xavier Simon, and how Simon mistreated a woman when he was drunk, how Simon's army buddies testified against Simon, and about how Simon swore a death revenge on everyone. Just the typical kind of story you'd tell a 5-year-old. Bruce wastes no time in hightailing it to Simon's office, and Simon wastes even less time before he begins a 4-page monologuing session, which we'll break down in the story breakdown. But his soliloquy ends with him putting on a mad thinker's cap and electrocuting himself. Boy, this story sure is boring. Then the room starts to seal itself off, and the body lowers into the floor, neither of which are very good signs, of course. Then a panel opens up from the floor. Something pulls Batman down into it by his cape. Sorry, Edna Mode. Power punches him back onto the floor, and as he's reeling, Batman sees a huge white gorilla emerge with a Mr. Mind voice box, letting Batman know that even though this story has ended, Xavier Simon's revenge plan is fully underway. What did you guys think of the story, Chris?
This is a great pulpy story. It's got beautiful art. And like you said, a villain who monologues like mad. And Batman even points it out that he's monologuing like mad. I think so meta. It's great. And it's got a great cliffhanger, which your next guest will get to discuss with you. So, yeah, it's a lot of fun. And this is Starlin's first Batman story as writer and penciler, and it's easy to forget because he's more known as the cosmic guy at Marvel, but he wrote one of the most controversial stories in Batman's history, of course, where a certain sidekick was beaten to death and then blown up. So he had a solid run in that era. So it's, I have to remind myself that Jim Starlin was a Batman guy. I've even interviewed him for Back Issue about some of that stuff. So it's kind of interesting. So here, this is Jim Starlin starting on Batman. So that's cool.
I like it too. It's a good setup. Great cliffhanger. This is the Ultra Humanite who's not the Ultra Humanite, which is kind of a funny thing. We've got a lot of weird body swapping stuff going on in the last few issues with the guy transplanting snake bodies onto people. And now this guy swapped his brain. But a good story. And I do like the art. It says actually that Starlin did the layout. So I think we're getting a lot more of P. Greg Russell than just the inking.
Yeah.
But you can still see flashes of Starlin for sure. Yeah, great stuff. I like how Batman is just really disgusted by the carnage that he sees in the room when he sees that the bodies have been torn apart and stuff. So pretty gruesome.
I do really like this story. I think it's great, but really it is all set up.
Yes.
The action is him swinging, trying to get out of the trap at the end and that kind of thing. Unlike some of the other stories that kind of weren't beat by beat worthy. I think we could go beat by beat, but really there's only three beats, four beats in the story. It starts off, Batman's in the park. All of the quote unquote narrator stuff, I kind of just rolled my eyes until I was thinking, I don't think it really is Batman talking, but I've retroed it to be Batman talking and now I like it a lot more. So then he gets interrupted. So he goes to talk to Commissioner Gordon. Now, I do think the art is fantastic in this issue, but both in the printed issue and online on the DC Universe Infinite app, I think you really have to be paying attention that it's one person because I don't think you really get that it's a body being torn up. I think because of either the coloring, how it's all just one kind of color. And I think you kind of miss that the lump that's above that guy's hand, his foot is there. Like that's his leg.
Yeah.
His hand, which is almost giving the middle finger, that's the same body. It's not two different bodies. I almost think the leg almost looks like something wrapped in a blanket. I don't really get that it's a pant leg with a foot at the end, but it is. And it's the same arm separated. I don't know if they had to color it that way because of the Comics Code Authority or...
Well, we know they can't use red. We know that the blood, yeah. I mean, all that liquid on the ground, although that's an ink thing. You know, although maybe that ink thing, maybe the Comics Code made them add that and maybe that was originally supposed to be blood.
Oh, yeah, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, this is actually pretty gruesome for a comic of this time, if you think about what you're looking at.
Right.
I get what you're saying. It's kind of a little hard to see the leg at first, but his right arm and his probably left leg are in two different parts of the room.
Not where they normally should be.
And the chair's all turned over and there's, okay, maybe it's ink, but the fact that there's a skull on the bookcase kind of also indicates death, even though I'm sure that's just part of the decor, but still. And the fact that Gordon says this is like the worst thing he's ever seen, so that says a lot too. Yeah.
And I like the next couple panels when Gordon and Batman are talking and Batman sees like the animal tuft of hair. And then especially on story page 5 where, so technically that top row is not a camera push in. But the way your eye leads across the room to the blood mark and then that photo above, then that next row is a camera cushion. You see Batman's eye and then the photo gets closer and closer and closer and closer. Then like that orange and red, like the realization, oh my gosh, I know what that is. And then out he goes. I think that's fantastic. Mm-hmm. And then he goes back to his bat cave in the center of Gotham City, the tree and the building in the city. It is funny that he has like all this stuff in a trunk in the bat cave.
I love that he took the time to move the trunk of his father's stuff from Wayne Manor to this bat cave. He could have just driven to Wayne Manor and looked at it there, but no, Bruce had taken the time to move his dad's stuff so he could look at it once in a while.
And then the neat thing is he pulls out that exact photo. So, you know, it has something to do with the past. I understand Bruce Wayne had to be like a certain age when his parents died. So because his dad had to tell him this story, he had to be a certain age. But like to tell a 5-year-old this and the 5-year-old remembers the photo. Definitely, you know, the story. He has a funny beard, dad. Yeah. Let me tell you all these horrible things he did.
Yeah, you know, and after he's done telling about this guy, then Thomas says, and then there was Lou Moxon. He swore he'd get me too. We were at a costume party and he busted in. I was dressed as a Batman. Blah, 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 you know.
All right, so I want to do a little math here.
I was told there would be no math.
Well, I'll do the math. This is 1978. So Batman's give or take 30 years old. So that means he was born give or take 1948. So he'd be, you know, like a baby boomer born after the war. But Thomas tells Bruce that he was a doctor in the army during the war. But then Xavier is pretty old and he talks about World War One.
Yeah.
Thomas was a doctor, which means he had to be pushing 30 to be an army doctor, let's say, in 1918. That would make him 60 when Bruce was born.
Yeah.
Why they particularly call out World War One didn't make any sense to me. The math major in me went a little kooky on that because I was like, this doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Yeah, I caught that too. I thought that was really strange. And Thomas Wayne's always been depicted as being pretty young when,
right.
when he's killed.
Right.
He couldn't have been much beyond his mid-40s or something.
Right, exactly. I mean, Bruce is like 8 when they're killed, right? So, right. you know, he's probably 35 to 45, you know, somewhere in that.
Yeah. Niche.
I don't know. I was about to make a Gabriel's Horn that, oh, the Gabriel's Horn would have been that Bruce was young enough to have a father who was in World War II. But then mm-hmm. I reread it and I was like, wait a minute, it's World War I. That doesn't make it a Gabriel's Horn.
And really, all they would have had to do is take out, I was a doctor in the army. All they would have had to say is, I was in the army.
Yeah, but even yeah. then, it's the reference to World War One that gets me, which yeah. is a lot farther away. That's 60 yeah. years away from this yeah. story. You know, he should have just referenced World War Two or Korea or something like that. It just puts a date on it and didn't make a lot of sense to me. That's all.
They could have made Simon a career military man who was their commanding officer.
Exactly.
That was older than them.
Right. And they had to, quote, betray him by testifying for the superior officer. And that would have made him mad. That would have all made sense. If he was 45 or 50 when they were 25 to 30, right? Then he could look that old. So that, yeah, that would have been a good solution, Chris. I'm going with you, Chris. That's my solution.
Okay, all right.
So of course, Batman realizes this and he tracks down Xavier Simon and they talk. And yeah, I don't know. There's probably like 3 lines of dialogue and then off Simon goes. it's not sepia tone memories, because sepia tone is kind of like the brown. There's a lot of orange and yellows and reds in this. So he's going back his trip down memory lane about how the trial and how they testified against him, and then he was thrown out, and then he found the diamonds, which explains away like all of the money that he has. Then of course he's in an accident. Then he keeps talking and talking and talking. And so I don't really think this, but I'll say this for the sake of this argument, though. You have this revenge against the people that have done you wrong. And then one of the people you want revenge die. And then like, so then that revenge is transferred on the son. So let's say he didn't have a son. Let's say a daughter. Would that still happen? Let's say he didn't have kids. Then who does that revenge go to?
The cousin Maven.
Yeah, really. Yeah,
she's over
yeah.
in the swing set.
He's going to show up at the Wayne family reunion
yeah.
to pick out who this revenge
just take out everybody.
To.
It's very biblical. Yeah, very biblical.
I'm not like a revenge-minded person. Forgive, forget. Living well is the best revenge. That kind of thing. I don't have a gorilla at the ready, but...
A weird one, too, is he just says, hey, I know that you're Bruce Wayne. Don't deny it, and it doesn't really matter. I'm going to get my revenge on you. He doesn't really know. He just guessed. I mean, that's the right. thing. He's using all the context clues, which make total sense, but he doesn't have any proof. He just guessed that Batman's Bruce Wayne, right?
It's similar to the way Ra's al Ghul explains away like how he knows.
But he goes into the Batcave and sees
right.
him.
That's right. That's yeah. much, much better. Yeah. But Simon doesn't, because this is before the ADA mandated that everything be handicapped accessible. You can't go behind the grandfather clock with the steps.
Yeah, there was no elevator at that time.
Right. Yeah.
There you go. I will, jumping back a few pages, I just noticed this while flipping through this guy. On page 59, story page 9, that middle bottom panel where his plane is crashed, that looks like Starlin and Russell doing a Joe Kubert bit. It looks very Joe
Kubert. It does have a lot of Kubert there. Yeah, it does.
Yeah. But you're going to draw like a World War One era biplane crash. Why wouldn't you go with Joe Kubert, right?
Yeah. Again, this was after the war. He found his diamonds, and it's still only World War One. Why does he wait 60 years for revenge?
Right, exactly. What's he waiting on?
Amazing, waiting for the gorilla technology, I guess.
Right, right.
This may be my favorite line of dialogue in all of Batman family history, because Simon says, "Don't bother to deny it. It really doesn't matter if I'm wrong, thanks to Professor Zamir." Professor Zamir was a very brilliant scientist who I shot in the head one day. It was a most appropriate place to shoot him, you know. You see, before I killed him, I financed him in his work on mental exploration. And I know he's not a scientist, but that's like mad scientist. I shot him in the head. A very appropriate place, because.
See, I don't know how reliable this guy is as a narrator, because he's clearly nuts. So he might have got his dates mixed up. Oh, there you go. You know what I mean? So Professor Xavier looks like Otto Octavius.
He does. He does. Oh, I noticed that too.
Yeah. I don't know that you could really call him an unreliable narrator or like a crazy man, because the next thing he does is put an electrocutioner's cap on his head and electrifies himself. So I don't know if your assessment of him, Chris, is really fair.
He's even crazier than you thought.
He's committed to the bit. So, of course, that's not the end of him.
You hear his electronic voice going around the room and it's circling around.
And then it's not a trap door. I don't know the opposite of a trap door, because it lifts up and pulls his cape in. And then I love like the shock horror, because then you see this gorilla coming out. And I think the gorilla may have been part of a nuclear explosion, because just like Ronnie Raymond has Professor Stein, you know, as a ghostly image, the gorilla has Xavier Simon as his like ghostly image.
Edited by Al Milgram.
There you go.
Firestorm all over this book. So did Jared Conway and or George Perez read this story before they brought back the Ultra Humanite in JLA number 195? Because that's where he first appeared in the gorilla form. So this predates that, because he was just, you know.
Oh,
he
does.
Yeah, he wasn't a gorilla before.
What number Justice League were we on? 161. You're right, Chris.
Yeah. So this is 2.5 years later, yeah.
Jim Starlin probably is just as mad about that as the money he didn't get for Thanos.
Yeah, probably so.
Wow.
He got that sweet KGB money from BBS.
He did. He didn't get the sweet KGB money. That's my favorite story about Jim Starlin. But yeah, anyway, yeah. I like it. I think it's exciting. There's a little bit of padding. It's like you said, a lot of monologuing. You wonder, Sean, I know you like the villains who have their bit, right? Have their theme. This guy doesn't really have a central theme other than transferring of the mind. Anytime you transfer your brain into a gorilla, you're committed, I think, right?
Well, and apparently it can bounce back and forth.
I guess you're right, because he murdered the people in the gorilla form.
In the gorilla form, yeah. He ripped up the town.
Yeah, he ripped up the town.
He's not transplanting the actual brain in like Ultra Humanite does. He says he perfected a process that you can basically put your brain in any size animal.
But the gorilla's brain's not in his body.
No.
Like Kong Gorilla. Like you've got Kong Gorilla who does that, but they swap.
Right.
Right. Bill and Kong Gorilla swap brains. And then that's why they have to lock up the human, because he thinks like he's a gorilla.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
But this guy's comatose.
Yeah. Basically takes over the mind of the gorilla when he goes, he dominates it.
Lots of gorillas at DC Comics. It's a tradition. Yeah.
Julius Schwartz, man. I mean, he wasn't the editor of this one, but he knew that sold comic books, right? Put a purple gorilla,
on the cover and you're all set. Yeah.
Yep.
Well, a lot of fun. I look forward to the resolution of this story next issue.
Okay, now, finally, we're going to take a trip to Gabriel's Horn, and maybe we'll look for that wife. In this segment, we'll take a trip to Gabriel's Horn, the hip happening hangout for the Teen Titans in the 1970s. We'll talk about the most 1970s moment in this issue from any of the stories. Chris and Paul, what do you have? How about you, Chris?
Dr. Smite smokes on a plane, which is the Concorde, which was retired in 2003, and later he smokes at the airport.
Yeah, that's all I have in the first story. There's the paper ticket, but you know, the paper ticket for the train, kids still get paper tickets. Plus, it was a decorative thing.
Yeah,
right. It was supposed to be old timey train ride. Alfred has to fly the Batcopter rather than just text Batman his discovery about the killer.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
He's got to cop it. He's got to take a pneumatic tube to the Batcopter, then fly to where Batman's at. You know, so very antiquated.
That's a good one. I don't have anything else in the first story. You, Sean? You have anything?
Nope.
And I got nothing in the Robin story. Do either of you have anything in the Robin story?
I've got one. I've got Margie Spratt's denim sleeveless jumpsuit.
Back cousins, you probably know I work in a library, but even if I didn't work in a library, I would have known this. On story page 4, the bottom panel on the left side, it's Robin's flying around because of his jetpack. He says, "I'll swing wide around the campus and then swoop in on the guy with the binoculars. Hawkman, I'm not. But at least I don't have any fear of flying." And you see how that's in quotes. Like off the top of your head, do you guys know what fear of flying is in reference to?
No, I do not.
Okay, I'm not going to explain it, but There is a book by Erica Yong called Fear of Flying. Bat Cousins, if you are over the age of 18, Wikipedia, Fear of Flying by Erica Yong.
Okay.
It's an erotic book. And I always knew it was an erotic book. I didn't really know what it was about. And then I Googled it and read it. I actually read it at work. It's a book, so it's probably okay that I did, and it's Wikipedia. But don't Google it at work. But that's the only one I had for...
1973 novel, figured in the development of second wave feminism. Okay.
How about the next story? Did you guys have anything?
Yeah, I think the whole way Don Heck draws the Chinese people... and the way Jerry Serpy colors them is a huge throwback to an earlier time in comics. It's similar to the way Heck drew them on Iron Man, but Wo Fong has fangs. I mean, this is almost World War II era. This is, I mean, when I read this, I'm like, ugh, it has not aged well at all.
But on a little later, we refer to Peking, not Beijing. So it was 1979 that the Imperial Post Office in China started using the new romanization system to change Chinese characters into Arabic letters. And eventually, it was until 1986 that the New York Times started using Beijing instead of Peking, and other media soon followed.
Mm.
So, but it was sort of started in 1979.
That's a great one.
That was my favorite one from the issue. Man Bat?
I have two. The most obvious one is the disco, like going to the disco, which I loved. If there only would have been some kind of soundtrack for this issue, I would have loved, you know, like a lot of times they'll put in curved font songs that are playing. I would have loved that.
Yeah.
But also the whole idea of like a bogey impression. It isn't necessarily only 1970s, but if you do a bogey impression now, people aren't really going to get what you're doing.
Yeah.
I guess if you say pork chops and apple shosh, they might understand. And that Brady Bunch reference, maybe? I think him doing a reference to Bogey is a reference to the 70s.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah, I did have one on that too, because Bard has Kirk filing newspaper clippings in the file cabinet.
That's a good one. And lots of smoking in this story by the PIs.
Yeah, so
we've seen that before. But yeah, it's definitely the whole disco theme is the winner here.
Yep.
And other than what I was saying before about the World War I, World War II, and the old enough, I didn't have anything in the last story
to
put it to the 70s.
No, not me. Pretty timeless otherwise. Yeah.
Awesome. Woof. Guys, what a marathon session. That I think that wraps it up.
That 10 minutes has flown by.
We do want to thank our special guest, Chris Franklin, for stopping by the reunion this month. Chris, I can't imagine that anyone listening to this does not know, but would you be so kind as to remind folks where they can find you?
Sure, guys. Thanks for having me. It's always just a blast to stop by the reunion, even if I have to deal with Cousin Steve and his never-ending Frisbee contest. But you can find my wife, Cindy, and I on JLUcast, where we discuss the Justice League Unlimited animated series from Bruce Timm and Company, as well as other shows in the DCAU canon. We just wrapped up coverage, by the time you hear this, on one of the best Justice League stories of all time.
Yeah, no great Matters episodes. Media,
the Cadmus arc, yep. After that, we take a break for 2 months to return to the House of Frankenstein over on Supermates. There we'll discuss a classic horror film and a comic featuring a favorite superhero tackling a similar monster. So this is our 10th annual House of Frankenstein, so please join. It's a lot of fun.
Well, thanks again, Chris. We appreciate it. We're going to play a podcast promo, and when we return, Sean and I will read and respond to your listener feedback.
Oh, autumn. The leaves change colors and begin to fall. The kids go back to school. Pumpkin spice becomes its own food group. And little ghosts and goblins are on the streets begging for candy. But something sinister awaits. Back in the woods among those dead trees sits a foreboding, dilapidated manor. You can't resist. You must go inside and return to...
the House of Frankenstein!
Did you hear that?
I heard that. What was it?
Listen to them. Children of the night. What music they make.
The Supermates podcast presents 4 spine-tingling episodes covering your favorite classic horror films featuring these iconic stars.
Griffin Dunn and David Naughton.
You're one of the undead, and I'm a werewolf.
Yes, that's right.
Bela Lugosi.
I am Dracula. I bid you welcome.
Claude Rains.
You're crazy to know who I am, aren't you? All right, I'll show you.
And Peter Cushing.
I can hear his voice.
It's in your own mind.
Plus, your favorite superheroes versus classic monsters.
I understand your concern, Mr. Wayne, but
But I don't think you need to worry that Wayne Tech is responsible for this invisible man.
But I seem to remember last year hearing something about an invisibility project.
Visit fireandwaterpodcast.com or your favorite podcatcher for the 10th annual journey into terror at the House of Frankenstein.
Not available in pumpkin spice flavor.
Welcome back. Now we will read and respond to your listener feedback for episode 20, Guest Stars Galore, with our special guest, Max Romero.
Hey, Sean, I want to remind our listeners that we, you and I, will be at the Baltimore Comic Con on Friday, September 8th, and we're going to be joined by one of our listeners, Brett Young. So we will be there Friday afternoon. So if you're going to be around, let us know and we'll maybe meet up. Sean will also be there Saturday and Sunday if anybody else is going to be in the vicinity of Baltimore. And then secondly, I want to say that we got a very nice comment on our recently dropped promo from Bat Cousin Bradley Glynn, who says, I feel the need to say that the Batman Family Reunion is possibly the most fun podcast on the Fire and Water Network. It's so positive. How can anyone listen and not smile a lot? Well, thank you, Bradley. That's really very, very kind of you to say. There's lots of good shows on the network. So for you to say something like that really means a lot to us. He does go on to say he's going to stop on the way to the next reunion and pick up a cheesecake with chair. But he can't guarantee it'll be intact by the time he gets there. So I thought that was cute. But thank you, Bradley, again. Look forward to seeing your comments more and let us know. There's still some open spots. Anybody, not just Bradley, for some future episodes if anybody wants to join us as a guest.
And now we're going to kick off the comments with a few quick hits. Brian Schufo says, the final issue of Batman Family, sob. But Siskoid responds, it's comics. A resurrection is always coming. Bucky749 also chimes in on the demise of Batman Family. Well, old chums, it's been fun, but it's time for this adventure to end. Another great show. Rob McCarthy says, oh, sure, Red Tornado and Ragman, but no Creeper? And Siskoid responds again, coming soon to a podcast near you. A message from Siskoid?
Bat Cousin Matthew Davis then stops by the reunion to say, I hope all the Bat Cousins are managing to stay cool. Thanks to 97% humidity, I've discovered that moisture-wicking shirts can drown when there isn't anywhere to wick the sweat to. First, thanks a lot, guys. The 80s musical interludes in the last couple of episodes made me wonder what other 80s songs the stories bring to mind. During my reread, I kept thinking about what song each story might inspire. Batman, Ragdoll by Aerosmith. The title sounds like this was Ragman's first appearance, or at least his reintroduction after a long absence. Not so much. I'm guessing that whatever plans DC had were a victim of the implosion. He does somewhat resemble Moon Knight. Was Moon Knight growing in popularity at Marvel at the time, and DC wanted to capitalize that? I'd have to look at the dates. I think Ragman was first, because he was a couple years before this, Matthew, but I'd have to look at the dates. At 11 years old, I don't remember being that excited and anxious to see more of Ragman, but looking back, it's too bad we didn't. I know he's become a little more popular in recent years and was adapted into the Arrowverse. Several great two-page spreads in this story by Michael Golden, even if pages 16 and 17 don't line up, but at least it wasn't just my copy. Robin and Batgirl's song is Hot in the City by Billy Idol, or Some Like It Hot by Power Station. At what point did Robin have that, I could have had a V8 moment, and realized he could use the JLA transporter to get from New Carthage to DC to help out Batgirl. And does Batgirl get the same privileges? I mean, she did max out her credit card for renting that plane a few issues ago, so fair's fair. Plus, now he's unattached. Forget about Lori. He can see her more often if he wants. Man-Bat, Private Eyes by Hall & Oates. That one was obvious. Two Michael Golden stories in this issue? I love it. And what a story the second was. Combat vet with a bum leg and scientist who can turn into a bat. Hey, I'd watch that buddy cop movie and be waiting to see the reboot 40 years later. In retrospect, doesn't Kirk telling Jason, Batman recommended me call him? Sounds like someone saying they know the business owner or manager when wanting some extra service or discount. I can't blame Jason for dismissing Kirk. And The Huntress, Fire by the Pointer Sisters, I'm on Fire by Springsteen, or Legs by ZZ Top. That's my favorite. One good thing about Helena laying low in her apartment, she didn't have to deal with Roger, and neither did we. And that shot of her, she came out of the shower and got her legs up. Now, I do remember being 11 years old and wanting to see more scenes like that. Fairly quick resolution to the story, but this three-parter gave us a chance to know The Huntress and her legs better. Most 70s moment, you guys caught the bulk of them. There was another 280Z in the Man-Bat story Golden probably had one back then. Let me add that the Power Star was a descendant of Betsy Ross as a leftover bicentennial minute.
Back cousin and past guest Ward Hill Terry says, I know that I missed this book on the stands and I had to get it as a back issue a little later because I was a Ragman fan. Ragman number one is my first comic.
Wow.
I know, that's great. That's the issue that made me start to collect comics rather than just read them and leave them. I missed most of Ragman's other issues too. I was upset that I missed this one. I can also remember reading the next issue and wondering, when did Man-Bat become a private eye? Now, I know I've been lax in chatting here with my Bat cousins, and I apologize for that, but I had to write quickly on this one. At minute 56 in the podcast, Max says, what is a high tension wire anyway? I looked it up. That's what a high tension wire is for. It's for completing an electrical circuit. So that's why it would work to drain off energy like that and induce feedback. Max was talking about the Power Sower, but he had also explained Ragman's origin. The crooks shot the high tension power lines onto Rory Reagan's dad and his buddies. They joined hands. Rory tried to pull them away. When he grabbed his father's hand, he completed an electrical circuit, which then drained off the energy of the old guys and induced feedback into Rory. You accept that electrical discharge in the form of lightning can strike the right chemicals and then give a police scientist superpowers. Well, can you accept that electrical discharge flowing out of a power line, striking the right chemicals from the bottles between the guys had been passing around, can give a vet semi-superpowers? Sure you can. Okay. Even when I was 12, I thought the Ragman origin was hokey, but Max has convinced me.
Terry, bring in the comic book science. Bat cousin, past guest, and future guest, Martin Gray, is next. Oh, heck. Look at these looming clouds. I do hope this family barbecue isn't rained off. Oh, well, I brought food anyway. Crumpets with butter and Marmite topped by melted cheese. So tasty. But not as tasty as this cover. It's a Paro level great. This is a special issue for me, as it was one of the few comics I was able to buy off the newsstands in the UK. It's not a great issue, but it's a special one. I know it's sacrilege on this show not to worship at the altar of Michael Golden, but I was back to not loving his art this time. I found it fascinating rather than attractive. Ugly beautiful at a push. His Ragman looks great. Reed held him back too much. More costumed Rory would have been great, but almost always his Batman head is awkward, like an Easter Island statue. The story wasn't bad. So Sean, do you have anything to say about this?
In this part of the script, Paul wrote in, Sean responds to this attack on Michael Golden, and it's not an attack. And what I was thinking is, he talked about the cover being a Paro level, so this is where the fandoms even each other out. So Rob Kelly, start listening to a Bob Dylan song for the next couple minutes, because you don't want to hear this.
Oh no, Sean, you're gonna get us kicked off the network.
I am not saying I'm not an Paro fan. I think he's fine, and I know people love him, and
I love him. I think he's my favorite.
I think I understand, but it just doesn't latch in with me the way Michael Golden does. So it kind of like evens it out, and you can write in the comments that I'm wrong, and that's fine.
Oh, I have a feeling someone will.
There's stuff of a Paro that I would say I like, and that's fine. There's nothing bad or wrong. It's not an attack.
Back to Martin. I hate the title of the Robin story too, because it looks like it should rhyme, but it doesn't. Which you said, but it bears repeating, as it put me in a bad mood before reading the story. I wonder if having Elongated Man and Red Tornado in here was Bob Rozsack saying, from now on, these are Batman family characters too. We're going to use them in strips. Because they did. I remember being confused by the revelation that the Super Pooper was a descendant of Betsy Ross, who I thought was a character in Spider-Man. Now, I realize I've defended Don Heck's art plenty of times, but what the heck was that excuse for a Red Tornado on the final page? Horrific. Yes, but he did have that other good page, so we'll give him that. The Man-Bat logo is terrible. Someone has badly copied and italicized the Batman from the regular Batman logo and not even bothered to make them even in length. I do like the Michael Golden art more here. We don't get weirdo Batman. Also, Bob Smith is excellent, but Joe Rubenstein is better suited to Golden. This was my favorite story in the issue, it having two good characters, compelling art, and a sharp Rozsackis script. The Huntress strip hasn't yet hit its stride. That comes soon in Wonder Woman. Here we have another dull adversary for Helena. Why does Batman family suffer from either terrible supervillains, such as this issue's thrower-upper, or none at all? And my gosh, that bad little kid is an ugly one. Hurry up and bring on Earthworm. The Marvel Comics issues with David Letterman and the not ready for primetime players were some of the most annoying non-funny comics I've ever met in my life. Who were these non-entities? What was primetime? The stunts were nothing but Marvel staffers crawling to local celebrities.
Okay, Martin. So on usually Saturday nights when you tweet all the stuff about the TV shows in England that I don't understand at all, so I just have to scroll by all 432 tweets. It's the same kind of thing. Saturday Night Live in the 70s and David Letterman in the 80s were fantastic. And even though Marvel and NBC were both in New York City, they were more than local celebrities. Like across America, people knew who they were. I don't know if David Letterman and Saturday Night Live transferred across the pond. They probably didn't. Maybe they did. I don't know. They're definitely bigger than local celebrities. But I do really, really want to thank Martin because I still have forgotten to go on eBay and get these issues. And I really need to get that done. So thank you, Martin. We're going to move on to Bat Cousin Tim Price, who just had to add, I thought Betsy Ross was the love interest of the Incredible Hulk.
You know, Sean, our Bat Cousins are really good at history.
And then Bat Fashionista Lynn Anton Oswald stops by. Impressive podcast, most impressive. The cover is cool. Ah, Ragman. I remember Joe Kubert art in the old Ragman comics, and that was great. Wait, wasn't Robin about to fight Raven? What about him? What about Raven? Hey, he's still around, Lizanne, as we saw in this issue. Still glad Dick is with his true love, Babs. Yep, the heat is easier to take in the Robin outfit. Still, Babs gets to enjoy looking at him in the shorts, so win-win. The full-page hero panel for Red Tornado was cool. Moving on, why can't men go around shirtless anymore? When did that happen? Kurt looks sexy and cool shirtless. And then, Lizanne brings some science to the reunion. As for the wire thing, I know a grounding wire is used in setups, like for the device used in films and plays for the lights. Maybe this is similar, and Robin is using that principle. And finally, cool hearing from the plastic cast guy.
Next up, we have my pal, Dan D, who says, I like this issue, but the power dynamic was certainly off in both the Ragman Batman and the Robin Batgirl stories, and that made these stories a little tough to swallow, but fun. Batman can mop up a room full of gun-toting, poker-playing criminals like these with one hand while eating a hoagie with the other. He doesn't need Ragman. Man. At the other end of the spectrum, Power Sower is taking down the power grid in the nation's capital, a la the day the earth stood still. I know Superman was away on business, but literally was no one else available? Dan, he got Red Tornado in there. You know, come on. That story also requires the suspension of disbelief that's needed in hundreds of comics, where there's some huge problem going on, and the only hero available to fight it is the titular hero. For example, rejuvenated dinosaurs running amok in New York City in a bronze Spider-Man I just reread. Anyway, the spans of your collective Batman and DC history of knowledge is awesome. Getting back into comics over the past few years, I originally missed out on the Bronze Age. Your podcasts are like masterclasses for me. Keep up with the great work. Yeah, that's my fault. I got him back into comics. Now he's spending tons of money buying up things he never got. Sorry, Dan.
And now, Bat Cousin and former guest Tim Price makes his full comments. Thanks for posting images from this issue. My only guess for DCU Finite is that they're missing the original pages for digitalization, or the pages have degraded and won't scan well enough. But I really have no idea. It's quite vexing. When I was reading JLA last year every day, the Zatanna origin arc was completely missing. Doom Patrol Volume 3 is missing the final two issues. And why, oh why, is the Blue Devil bonus debut story cut out from Fury of Firestorm number 24? Vexing! So in lieu of discussing the stories, I'll say my little ears perked up at the mention of Dr. Dundee, an interesting supporting character that I first met in the Bat comic cousin Batman and the Outsiders number 3, and whose history I didn't know until rereading that issue for my podcast and looking him up on the Googles, information age and all of that. And I can't help but mention that Jason Bard is an important part of Batman and the Outsiders number 16, The Truth About Halo, Part 1. Say what you will about Batman and the Outsiders, but it did include interesting characters from Batman's past. And last, I think the three of you should launch a new podcast, Rags to Riches, the Ragman and Richie Rich podcast. You're welcome. Great show as always, Bat Cousins. I can tell all of my Bat Cousins I will do a Richie Rich podcast before I do a Superman Family podcast. I love Superman Family. I want to listen to the Superman Family podcast. I will be a guest on the Superman Family podcast, but I will not do a Superman Family podcast.
Yet another past and future guest, Bat Cousin Brett Young stops by the reunion. Hey, Bat Cousin, sorry I'm late. I brought some Turkey Hill iced tea and Spam. That's right, Spam. They can't all be winners. Cool issue. Of course, I had to go to the dark web to read it. I didn't realize Ragman was so precious. I got so many pop-ups. I'm probably going to have to burn my computer. Michael Golden's art on the Batman story was fantastic as usual. The fight scenes were really well orchestrated, though I don't know why he drew Gordon like he's the day manager at Arby's. Sean, how can you describe Bruce's place as an apartment? The Wayne Foundation building is the single greatest construct of the DC universe. We don't see that much of it in this issue, but a giant business tower with a tree growing through it must be paid respect. Think of how many drunk employees tried to climb that thing during the office Christmas party. And it's topped off by Bruce Wayne's majestic cocaine fever dream of a penthouse. It's got a freaking moat, sunrooms, and probably a sunken living room with a disco ball. Plus, there's nothing preventing someone from falling to their death except some shrubbery around the edges. He's got to lose 2 or 3 girlfriends a year from that. I can't decide if the building's architect should be arrested or sainted. The Robin, Batgirl, Red Tornado, Discount Plastic Man story was okay. An alarming amount of red and yellow. Batgirl and Robin should be careful at that power station. They're going to really feel the heat. Burning you up, ready or not. Red Tornado is not one of my favorites. Maybe it's the pants, but I like that Heck made him look like Yul Brynner. As for the villain, maybe instead of dressing like BDSM Hulk, she could have done what normal people in Washington, D.C. do. Use nepotism to establish themselves, start a foundation to raise money or awareness for a cause, eventually testify before Congress, be scoffed at and told her concerns are flawed because it snowed once last January, then join a lobbying firm. That's how things don't get done in this town, Missy. My God, look at Jason Bard's place. Maybe Bard charges clients double to go incognito in purple pants. It's nicer than the barely making ends meet Langstrom's cathedral ceiling 2-bedroom Manhattan apartment. Man, I wish real estate worked like it does in the DC universe. Sean, thank you for sharing that Park City story. I would get the occasional comic store gift card, actual paper gift card, kids, for my birthday or Christmas. And I wrung every cent out of them with a mix of current stuff plus the 25-cent bin. I also won a couple gift cards for art contests that were judged by Tim Truman. He lived in Lancaster and became friends with the owner when they moved the comic store to the Golden Triangle Shopping Center on Lititz Pike. That's cool. Okay, got to run. We just got word that Great Aunt Hazel was on her way to the reunion, but got run off the bridge by a VW bug. Looks like she's sleeping with the fishes.
Okay, Bat Cousin Brett Young, I know you're trying to win me over with a mention of BDSM Hulk and Park City and the power station, Some Like It Hot. But you, sir, when you refer to Spam as not being a winner, I love Spam. I think Spam is great. And finally, future guest Bat Cousin Captain Entropy says, thanks for another great episode, Paul and Sean. I brought my wife's amazing stir-fry chicken lettuce wraps. Take my advice. Skip the lettuce and get a fork. The greenery only slows you down. I'm looking forward to hearing about the Batman family in The Days of the Dollar Detective, a Batman Richie Rich crossover. One note on Ragman. I didn't discover the character until a few years after this. By that time, DC had revealed that the character was Jewish, not Irish, as reflected in the Arrowverse. This revelation came with a modification to his origin, which had been fussed with a few more times since then. Anyway, they definitely added some needed depth and context to the character. For anyone who would like more information, there is a fun, informative, inspiring, and sometimes heart-wrenching podcast called Funny, They Don't Look Jewish. Therein, Henry Bernstein and Rabbi Brandon Bernstein, no relation, review comics with explicitly Jewish content. Yes, I copied these sentences from my Sabra comment over on Uhatmu or not, I gave myself permission. Now, we are going to take a look at our social media. We want to thank everyone for interacting with us on Facebook and Twitter. So anytime a Disney park or attraction changes its name, I always try to get right on that and cement in my mind that that's the new name. And I always try to use that name. But I'm always going to call it Twitter. Until Twitter is literally no more, I'm going to call it Twitter. So on Facebook, we were liked and mentioned and forwarded and all of that by Chris Franklin, Brett Young, Mike Thomas, Codex Omniversa, Magazine and Monsters, Paul Wildenberger, Doug Game Master, Ed Bell, Herschel Mimas, Alistair James Dunbar, Don Lindbergh, Carol Teague, and Tom Pinsonault, who said, great show, gentlemen. And on Twitter, we were liked, mentioned, followed, forwarded, smoke screened, all of that by Jim Ball, Liz Ann Oswald, Martin Gray, Groupie, Ryan Schufo, Rodney Trainum, and Between the Pages blog.
All right, that's about it. Before we sign off, I think you all know Running the Fire and Water Podcast Network has gotten a lot more costly over the years as more and more shows were added. So if you are enjoying what you hear on this show or any of the other shows, please consider becoming a patron. We're not all Bruce Wayne, but any small amount you can give helps defray the cost, and we promise that none of the money will go towards more costumes for Robin. To find out how, go to patreon.com/FW podcasts. And thanks.
That will do it for this feedback section. We want to thank our special guest, Chris Franklin, for appearing on this episode. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us next month.